Good evening. This is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. We're reconvening on Wednesday evening at 5:30 of March 11th, 2015. Please join us, Senator Wieger, on Senate File 1071. Senate File 1071 has been presented by Senator Wieger earlier today, and we had some wonderful testimony on the bill. I just would remind you of some of the essential elements of the bill that we're going to begin having a conversation now with the author about the bill and about any concerns that the committee might have. So Senate File 1070 would increase the training requirements for healthcare workers and increase staffing and security levels. The bill would create a system where violent workplace events would be reported to the Commissioner of Health, and hospitals would implement a preparedness and incident response plan. The measure proposed in the bill seeks to prevent healthcare workplace violence from occurring, and if it does, require the hospitals to have a plan in place. It contains four main components. The first mechanism by which the Commissioner of Health can suspend or revoke a license of a hospital if the Commissioner finds that the hospital interfered with the worker's ability to report violence, or retaliated against them for that reporting, or was not adequately prepared to address the violence, or did not address the violence. Second, the bill requires the commissioner to develop and maintain an electronic violence prevention database. It would be available for care workers to provide information about violent incidents in the workplace or put concerns about the hospital's compliance with the preparedness requirements, the hospital's response to the violence or actions in a report. The commissioner has to develop recommendations for hospitals on preparedness for and response to violent incidents. Third, the bill places several requirements on hospitals. One includes an establishment of a committee made up of its employees to develop preparedness and incident response plan and to provide an annual training. And fourth, the bill places some requirements in relation to the hospital's implementation of the bill's provisions. The hospital cannot interfere with the worker's ability to contact law enforcement or the commissioner about an act of violence. And finally, the hospital has to implement a procedure where a worker can request increased staffing levels. If the hospital denies the request, the hospital has to provide the worker with a documented reason and may have to provide the document to the commissioner. That's the essence of the bill that we heard earlier today, and we've also received testimony. So we're back on the bill. Senator Wieger, would you like to make some other additional comments at this time before we discuss the bill?
No, Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Okay, so I guess I need to take the bill from the table, and with that, we can begin discussion. Is there any discussion on the bill at this time? Senator Benson. Yes,
thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Wieger. I'm trying to actually get to my marked up copy from earlier, but there is a section where a healthcare worker could file a report with the Department of Health. I would like you to address, and I know we're going to judiciary at some point with the data, but is that healthcare worker anonymous? Is the data private data? Here's my concern. An incident happens, and then in the second part, the person's allowed to make comments about if there are adequate security protocols in place and things of that nature. Person could make any comment that they would like. It's not necessarily vetted by the department. If that data is public, a media person could do a data practices request, and all of a sudden, very negative comments about a hospital become public without any filter, any vetting. So if you could talk a little bit about that for me, please.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Benson. Very good concerns, and I'm going to ask Mr. Tollefson from the MNA to address those.
Please introduce yourself to the committee and begin to answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Tollefson, and I'm a government affairs specialist with the Minnesota Nurses Association. And this particular part of the bill is in reference to data that could be collected from an incident that might not rise to the level of a report to the police or an adverse event or something of that nature, but is an important event that took place with the healthcare worker, where the healthcare worker experienced some element of violence, and so that it would be a mechanism whereby that healthcare worker could report the incident to the Department of Health to avoid the judicial sector, so that prosecution doesn't take place necessarily against the patient who might be suffering from dementia, reaction to medication, or something of that sort, and so that the incident can still be reported, that data can still be collected, so that we can continue monitoring and evaluating violence prevention mechanisms and programs that are in place in hospitals to continue to develop those best practices, to learn from them, and to make sure that those are being implemented across the state so that all hospitals are safe.
Senator Benson.
And Madam Chair and
Mr. Tollefson.
Mr. Tollefson, I'm sorry. And we just spoke earlier. Mr. Tollefson, I understand the intent, but there are very real consequences to not having this data be private. It doesn't say that they're required to report the incident to their employer. So their employer, one of the most important parts of an incident is that there's an after action report to management and the opportunity to mitigate problems going further. So if an employee experiences an act of violence or abuse, as is defined here, and they don't tell their supervisor, but they merely tell the department, how is that helping in the iterative process of improving safety at the hospital?
Mr. Tollefson.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, our intent is certainly not to embarrass the hospital in any way by making comments that would then be public to embarrass the hospital. It's really meant to be limited to that what actually happened, what requests were made for support or security, or you know what was in place at the time to prevent the act, or what attempt was made to prevent what ended up happening, not any of the names or the situations or any unbased opinions. That's certainly not our intent.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Tollefson, you would be asking a healthcare worker to opine on the hospital's preparedness to respond to an act of violence or abuse. What if that healthcare worker is not fully apprised of all the resources that are available? What if they don't know that hospital security regularly communicates with the police in the community? What if they're simply not aware? And what if they don't know the full response of the hospital to the incident? This isn't an examination of the incident. This is one side telling their story, and we're now putting it in a public database, and any legislator can request the information, and it will end up in a committee somewhere, and it will be turned into legislation telling the hospitals to do even more. I get really concerned because this does not require any vetting other than published by the person who typed it. And Senator Wieger, I want to know that you understand my concerns and if you've thought about this and if you have any plans to address it going forward.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, indeed I thought about it, and I, after the committee hearing, I had asked the Hospital Association and others if we could commence some discussions. There being acknowledgement that there is an issue regarding abuse and violence and the need for collecting information, there's perhaps differences of opinion as to reporting, et cetera, but on privacy and other safeguards, that it be done in a prudent way, that needs further work. And I did give various stakeholders a commitment that we would collaborate on doing that if this bill was to pass to judiciary. You have my commitment. It's an issue that needs additional work. I believe the MNA recognizes that as well.
May I just want to get clear about something that you're asking. because this is just coming clear to me, is the process that what's being developed here is a database that's held at the department, the DHS, and it allows an employee, if an incident occurs, to enter that into a violence
prevention database.
Prevention database.
Yes.
And that's regardless of that's just a report. It's like a report of an incident that is not vetted or not. It's just what somebody is saying happened. It's their perspective. It's their report. It's sort of like a reporter of a child abuse situation to a reporter. It's not determined to be valid or invalid or correct or incorrect. So it's simply somebody making a report, correct? And then it's then that report is, without any vetting, put on this database. Is that what you're saying? Without knowing whether or not there's been an adequate response, or you know, maybe the nurse says there wasn't and the hospital says there was. How is that dealt with in this system when you have something kept on a database?
Well, Madam Chair, the database is meant for the monitoring and evaluation of processes that are in place or not yet in place to prevent violence in the first place. So it's not, there's no determination in, according to the language, there would be no determination made based on each and every report, but simply a way for the Department of Health to collect that data so that they have a basis to make any recommendations or changes in the future, so that they actually have some real evidence behind any decisions going forward. Because we're missing that right now.
I understand that, Mr. Tullison, but it am I correct that the database gathers the information and it's used for the future guideline establishment by the department, but nothing in what you're saying says that the Department of Health needs to make certain that the parties agree that that's what happened here? Because they'll start setting guidelines on the hospitals that may be based on a set of reports that they disagree with the interpretation of what happened, and they don't. It doesn't sound like there's anything in that step other than a gathering of complaints from people about their experiences of violence in the workplace. Is that correct? And is this data just kept and not? It's not public. It's not available to the public. It's not known to the public. Or is it available to the public?
Madam Chair, that the intention is that it would be kept in the Department of Health, and it's really to give a voice to that person who right now doesn't have a voice outside of the hospital, if indeed that person has a voice within the hospital. And so it just brings to the attention of the Department of Health that there are issues going on that need to be addressed, or that in the opinion of that professional need to be addressed. And so that the Department of Health can use that information in their professional judgment to make recommendations or to evaluate the prevention processes that are in place. But it would not be a report. It wouldn't necessarily rise to the level of something, for example, like adverse events, where there would be, you know, an investigation on each and every report, an incident where both sides are brought into that. I mean, the Department of Health could certainly do that under this authorization, but that wouldn't be required in each case.
And I'm not clear. I want to absolutely clearly understand that this data that's collected at the department in a database is not distributed to anybody outside of the department. Is that, am I correct about that? And is the language in here clear about that?
That's correct. That's our intention. And if the language is not clear, then we can certainly clarify that to everyone.
I think that may need to be clear. Senator Benson.
Actually, Madam Chair, I defer to Senator Lurie. He has a to-the-point question.
Senator Lurie.
I was going to say, to that point, I don't think that the bill is specific about that, and I don't sit on judiciary. I'm glad not to sit on judiciary. but my understanding from several trips through judiciary is that there is a built-in assumption that notwithstanding any statement to the contrary, there's an assumption that data is public. Mm-hmm. And so in the construct of the bill today, it would actually be public. So that would be something that judiciary will step you through in great and painstaking detail.
And
but
I am on judiciary, and I can confirm that that is true. And also that because there appears, at least as I understand the bill, a potential consequence to the hospitals, then everybody's going to want to be really clear that there's due that if that's the case, then there's due process, that there is an opportunity for a conversation, a clearinghouse, in the same way that anybody would have under any other circumstances when a complaint is or a set of information that's describing a phenomena. I can see that you want something that's put in there, and maybe the Department of Health sees a pattern and might want to initiate a conversation with that hospital. But I think it would require a more comprehensive conversation with the players before anybody would want to implement any consequences or guidelines. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as we look at page 2, line 32 and 33, and then compare them to page 4, line 31 and 32, the language is very parallel, so that whatever is reported there could be subject to penalties based on the judgment of the commissioner, and I see no place for due process on those complaints. And if you look at line 4.25, suspension or revocation of a license if the commissioner determines, I get really concerned when we're revoking hospital licenses without a significant amount of due process between report and follow-up. I'm really getting uncomfortable with this electronic database being built as it's structured.
Whoever would like to respond, Senator Wieger.
Well, Madam Chair, I wanted to reiterate that there will be meetings with stakeholders should there be some subsequent steps. I believe there is some cross-reference on due process, Mr. Tolleson.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, in current statute, this addresses subdivision 7 of section 144.55, but subdivision 7 outlines the due process for this entire act. So if that's not printed in the legislation because that's current law, but subdivision 7 includes a hearing committee in the Department of Health the Department of Health must prove that this was committed in that hearing, and it also allows for reinstatement of the license when the issue is addressed. So that due process is in current law in subdivision 7.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, Council
Senator Benson
was pointing me to that as we moved along. Is this, for those of you who've been through hospital licensing bills before, I'm asking in general, does this rise to the level of gravity where people go for a license review in front of the commissioner? I'm trying to grasp how much detail there is here and how many incidents would accumulate before the commissioner would call a hospital forward for a license review.
I'm not prepared to answer that question. Is somebody here from the licensing division from the Department of Human Services or Department of Health? I don't think they would be here anticipating that. Welcome. Would you like the question repeated?
Yes.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry I didn't catch the testifier's name.
Did you say your name?
No, I haven't yet. Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Stella French, and I'm a planner with the Health Regulation Division at the Department of Health. And could you please, Madam Chair?
Yes. What we're looking at is the penalties that are in place in this Senate file for a hospital not engaging in an effective prevention or response plan to workplace violence, and whether or not what the department that does a lot of licensing and deals with this kind of penalties, how you're reacting to this, and more specifically from Senator Benson, if I may speak for you, Senator Benson, is this in line with other kinds of problems or difficulties that get reported about a hospital as it relates to affecting their license and their ability to operate under their license?
Well, first of all, many of the hospitals are federally certified, and so there are federal regulations that also apply. We normally don't see for reports that level of a penalty. If there was something serious that someone was harmed or received harm, then the Center for Medicaid and Medicare may choose to say that a hospital could lose their license, but they always get a chance to come forward and present evidence or mitigate whatever the violation is. So this is something we don't normally see.
Senator Benson, anything further?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's all I have along that line. I certainly don't want to monopolize
Senator Rosen?
The questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a lot in this bill, and we could spend probably the entire time on Subdivision 4 on page 4. But my question is actually to what is already being done, and I was especially intrigued with Ms. Playman's testimony from CentraCare, and she talked about the MOAB, the Management of Aggressive Behavior. I was listening, taking notes, and that they were working on sharing best practices and an interdisciplinary team that's been brought together to collaborate on some of these issues. And I really find that, I think it's on page 4, line 10, a hospital shall provide training to all healthcare workers employed and contracted with the hospital. I think some of this is already in place, and I believe that we already have the bedrock already set in place to springboard off that and keep going on a lot of the good work that the Department of Health has already put into place, and a lot of the hospitals been put into place. So I believe that, you know, it's not really a question, Senator Weaker, but this is redundant, I believe, as far as, you know, what we're asking the hospitals to do. Some of it's unreasonable as far as a lot of paperwork instead of getting to the business of caring for patients. And when we get into the penalties, I'd like to talk about that, because it seems like we're setting up a system that is going to be extremely difficult for the hospitals to even reach. And then, therefore, the ability to care for our patients is going to be compromised.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen.
Senator Weaker.
Thank you. I believe the St. Cloud testimony was an excellent example of best practices and something that deserves, you know, emulation. I believe that healthcare workers are also very interested in patient care. And you mentioned that the hospital's administrators are. Well, the direct patient care is from the healthcare workers, the tens of thousands of them. And this is in behalf of their concerns, as expressed through their organization, that they ask for this attention. I would commend, though, the testimony, you know, showing good practices that are being done, but the evidence was, you know, more needs to be done. I wouldn't say it's redundant. In some cases, there's much more that needs to be done, and I'm just basing it on what testimony that I had received from the Nurses Association plus others.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, and I appreciate and understand your willingness to bring this forward, Senator Weaker. If that was the case and it was truly about safety in the workforce, which every hospital, every person that works in that hospital is concerned about safety for themselves and for their patients, that is primary, then we should not be having the sentences on page 3, line 28, a hospital shall create and implement a procedure that allows health care worker to officially request additional staffing. So I'm wondering if this is truly about staffing or if it's truly about safety and additional staffing. So that is the question.
Senator Wieger.
Well, Madam Chair, first and foremost, it's about safety. It's about prevention, violence prevention, to the extent that staffing may in part contribute to that goal, and looking at how that could further improve the prevention efforts, it needs to be at least acknowledged. This is not a mandate to increase staffing. It does put that as a factor if one chooses in terms of what would be reported. And again, what the Department of Health would do in its recommendations and looking at best practices would ultimately just tell that local hospital, come up with a plan in collaboration with law enforcement and with workers. It would not mandate anything regarding staffing, as I read it, and that could be made clear if necessary.
Madam Chair. Senator Eaton.
Thank you. I would just like to say, as having worked as a staff nurse, that I think what this bill does is get to the point to where it's kind of a accepted premise that nurses should just know that part of the risk of being a nurse is getting injured, and that they should just accept that or go work somewhere else type of attitude. At least that's what I got a lot when I was working, especially in the treatment centers. It's like it's an unacceptable expectation that it's part of the job, and that's what I think this bill addresses.
May I suggest a couple of things here? First of all, one of the questions is whether or not, since hospitals are already implementing these plans and have such excellent practices, that this is necessary. I'm inclined to say that because there's best practices there, it'd be fairly easy for hospitals to implement their duties that are described in this plan. It would encourage all hospitals to do this. Some are likely to do it without this nudge. Others may need an additional assistance. But in the context of Subdivision 3, in the area of D, where you're talking about, I think where you're talking about workers, requesting workers in relationship to Senator Rosen's reading of this, that it looks like it's a, you know, increased staffing, I would encourage you to develop language that that instead of requesting, officially saying requesting more staff, that a part of what they develop is a methodology for getting more staff support when the behavior of a patient appears volatile or unstable. In that way, it is a part of the planning process for how to, because we increase staffing lots of times when there are aggressive patients, and that's one of the ways in which we can create an atmosphere that is more safe both for the patients and for the clients. But rather than a specific statement about a procedure for requesting additional staffing, it ought to be a methodology for getting, you know, the physical supports they need in order to deal with a potentially aggressive situation. May I have a reaction to that from Mr. Tullison?
Well, Madam Chair, absolutely. That would be a good way to study this, because when we mention staffing here in this bill, it's completely unrelated to staffing at the level of the number of patients who are assigned to a nurse at any one time. That's a separate bill, and that's not what we're here to discuss today. But the staffing reference here is, you know, to security staff, to certified nursing assistants, to anyone who's nearby. When you say I need help, if you're going to go into a room to provide required care to a patient who is threatening in some way, and no one's around or available to go into that room with you, that's a dangerous situation. And so, is help available to you just from someone being around or for someone else going in with you? not anything about you know, how many nurses are on duty or anything like that.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Tollefson, if that's the case, then we need to reword this, because this does not provide that type of coverage or comfort.
Thank you. I draw from my own experience a little bit when and I know that Senator Eaton knows this as well, that when we're in a unit where the chances of somebody becoming agitated or overly aggressive, there's a plan in place for a call, some kind of a call system, just like when there's another kind of an emergency like a cardiac arrest, that there ought to be a system in place for call to bring additional support and security staff in. And I think that's what we're talking about here. We just need to articulate that a little better. Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Wiegert, Ms. Tollefson. I want to go just up a little bit, maybe a little higher. As I was talking to folks on all sides of this issue, one of the things that became pretty clear, I don't know what's going on with this, what became clear was that there seems to be an increasing amount of workplace or violence in the hospital setting. Like, there just seems to be more. And no one has shown me data to that effect, but that everybody seemed to agree that a lot more was going on. So one of the things that I would think that we would, and I don't know if this bill is the right venue to do it, but we're kind of dealing with the issue as it happens, but should we not be thinking about why we have an increasingly more violent work setting in hospitals? So I was not overly impressed, Senator Wiegert, with the video that you showed, from the standpoint that we've all saw that, but it didn't really give us the context of who that patient was, what was going on with them, and why they did what they did. So, you know, that it was a person that could have, whatever the context is, and I don't want to misstate it, but I know that we have, you know, an aging population. We deal a lot with dementia and Alzheimer's and people that get agitated for that reason. We have a population, we have a lot of folks that have mental health and chemical health issues. We're dealing with mental health issues here and the lack of facilities and places for those folks to go, especially at the acute state. We have an increasing chemical health issue that is much more complex than just simply alcohol detox, the opioids, and other issues that people have to start to figure out. And we're dealing with all of this, Senator Wiegert. I know that you're not a member of the committee every day. So I'm trying to figure out, like, what is going on, and then what are the things that we need to do to be able to not only respond when someone is agitated at that moment, but what's happening in the workplace that we're increasingly getting more people who seem to be more agitated and seem to be more likely to commit these kinds of issues in the hospital setting. And so, Madam Chair and Senator Wiegert, I want to be able to continue to work on this bill and figure out how to make sure that we're getting at the sweet spot. But there seems to be something a little more upstream, if I may borrow our chair's language a lot, something a little more upstream that starts to speak to this issue of what is going on and why our healthcare professionals, in particular our nurses who are here today, are having to deal with much more agitated patients. And so I don't know if you guys have thoughts on that, or if you've been thinking about, even to the testifiers or others, what is happening and what can we do to not put folks in such harm's way that we need to put more security guards, CNAs, techs, nurses, or whoever else that we think, law enforcement, which I hope that that's not what we're trying to do, to be there to deal with this issue.
Senator Hayden, are you wanting a discussion about the root causes of increasing workplace violence in the context of this bill?
Well, Madam Chair, maybe that's not what I want today, but I do want to put that on the record that I think that we're dealing with an issue. We're dealing with the result of it, but we're not dealing with the root cause. And so maybe that's not a question that we can answer today, Madam Chair, but I think that if we don't think about that in its context, then we're kind of spinning our wheels a little bit about this issue, as opposed to thinking about what are all of the other things that are causing the increased incidence of workplace violence.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. I agree with what Senator Hayden is saying. I don't know if we want to add an expectation to the department that they do an analysis of whether or not workplace violence is increasing. This database is part of being able to get the information gathered where something like that, I think, can begin to occur. But not tonight, because we need to set some parameters around the time we're going to spend on this bill. But I don't want to lose track of what Senator Hayden is suggesting, which is we need to take a look at what's happening. Because in earlier testimony, Senator Hayden, there was talk about very different kind of admissions occurring in general hospitals, very different kind of admissions occurring on psychiatric units that haven't traditionally had the responsibility to carry highly aggressive patients. And part of it has to do with this new 48 rule that we have that puts people in Anoka, and then people in the general hospital can't get them out of there into Anoka. So there is a complex set of contributing factors. But the bottom line here is that the nurses are asking for, until we figure that all out, we need to have a response plan for the violence that is existing under current conditions that we're struggling with. And so this bill has two components, asking the hospital to develop a plan for dealing with this, and then a set of commissioner duties around gathering data, and then consequences to the hospitals. And I share the concerns about the consequences at this level to the hospital, so I just want to share that. Did I miss somebody over here? Oh, Senator Wicklin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this. This document was in our packets about preventing violence in healthcare. It looks like all the major parties are working on this, and I just wondered, where does this fit in the work that's going on? Is this in progress, or is this something that's completed? It looks like, you know, a gap analysis is it in progress or completed, or have you drawn any conclusions from it? I mean, it looks like what this was hoping to accomplish is to find ways to implement best practices, which is, it seems like, the goal of the, you know, both the nurses and hospitals.
Mr. Tolleson?
Madam Chair and Senator Wicklin, the gap analysis as provided by the Department of Health is a result of a working group that included Minnesota Nurses Association and several hospital administrators, and is geared exactly at what you're talking about, which is developing best practices and how hospitals can implement those best practices. So the language of the bill is largely drawn from the gap analysis, and in terms of training, in terms of prevention, and what was actually done when a healthcare worker noticed an incident of maybe more minor aggravation or something. Was something changed in the care after that because it was a sign of, you know, potential violence to come? So this gap analysis is very much a useful tool for any hospital to implement prevention plans. And so the bill takes essentially the gap analysis the one step further to make sure that this is being implemented in every hospital around Minnesota, to avoid the piecemeal approach that we have now, where some hospitals are implementing best practices, others are not.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was thinking about the workplace violence issue that Senator Hayden brought up. Workers' comp looks at workplace violence, and not being on any of its relevant committees, does DALI already have workplace violence experts, people who do incident management? I just want to make sure we're not putting things into the Minnesota Department of Health that they don't have a skill set for. I'm not sure where overall training and responsibility for response to incidents and preparation for incidents at our workplaces in Minnesota happens, because it's not just hospitals. We're seeing it in many more places.
Do you want to respond to that, or do you want the Department of Health to respond to the question? Is the department still here? Department of Health, the question is about... Hello. Please introduce yourself to the committee.
Excuse me. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Diane Ryderick, and I direct the Health Policy Division at MDH. And if you could repeat the question. Thank you.
I'll paraphrase the question.
Thank you.
Does the department have the ability to carry out the responsibilities of training and and oversight that are described in this bill?
Madam Chair, I would say that we haven't really had an opportunity yet to speak with Senator Wieger and with the Nurses Association about what some of those expectations would be. And we'd like to have a chance to clarify that, clarify some definitions and roles and expectations before we know the answer to that. I think I heard from Senator Wieger that that would be a conversation that we can have going forward. To Senator Benson's question, I know the Department of Labor and Industry does collect some data on instances of workplace violence. I don't know whether it is within their scope to be developing responses to that. So that would have to be a question to them.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to briefly state that in my experience in doing a chain analysis of a causal effect of a lot of these incidents, it generally comes down to recognizing behavior or things that were leading up to it early on. And I think part of the issue that we have here is the elephant in the room, not enough staff. If you've got too many patients to watch, you can't catch these things early. And that was one of the things that we noticed in several of the units I worked on. If you don't have time to notice that somebody's getting agitated, they often get to the point of being violent before you can intervene. So that's just my 2 cents worth.
Well, thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm glad Senator Wicklund brought the gap analysis up. I do appreciate the department, again's work on bringing all these stakeholders to the table. I think the work that they are doing in this gap analysis, had a chance to take a look at it, is very important. So I just question again why we have a bill in front of us when there are stakeholders already doing this, Mr. Tollefson. And wouldn't it be nice to have a bill in front of us that every single one of these stakeholders in this gap analysis could be up here saying, I support this bill, this is the right thing to do. Instead, we have a very long, lengthy hearing on something that's a little controversial, understood, is built up with some penalties. And so I think it's important, too. I would like to hear from the Hospital Association about this also at some point, because I don't know if we had the Hospital Association yet, Madam Chair.
I would honor the request of I think we had some representatives of the Hospital Association presenting earlier today about what two hospitals are doing and the belief that this should be a local independent decision. If there's something that Ms. Krinke, that you would like to add to that?
Or Ms. Reed, or Madam Chair, or Dr. Reed could answer the question actually of Senator Hayden's, why we're having more of these incidences also, too. I think that would be important.
Madam Chair and Committee.
I'm going to interrupt now. Senator Rosen, I think I'm going to say the same thing to you as to Senator Hayden. I think the root cause analysis as to why violence is occurring is a separate subject from this. This is a request from the nurses to have a plan in place to deal with the you can do the long-term analysis and planning, but right now they need a plan in place, which has been implemented in a couple of hospitals, to deal with workplace violence. This hearing will go on very long if we start to talk about what the root causes are and what's driving workplace violence. So I really am going to set a limit on that for this meeting and try to stay focused on the question for anybody from the Hospital Association about what, if there's anything you need to add to your testimony, which I heard to be that there are places that are implementing workplace violence plans and that you would prefer to have this remain within the discretion of each hospital. That's the essence of what I heard is your testimony.
Madam Chair, I just have a couple of items.
Name? You have to give your name.
My name is Laura Reed, and I'm the Chief Nurse Executive from University of Minnesota Medical Center. I think the outcome, the desired outcome from the bill and what we're asking for is good. When I look at what we want to try and accomplish is identified in the patient safety workplace violence prevention program that has been a collaborative effort of all the entities that were identified. The part for me is that to have a summary report or something that would identify and be able to help us see from a public safety perspective where our opportunities are related to workplace violence prevention, that makes total sense. It's very difficult, though, as a nurse leader and a nurse who is still on the floor and really experiencing exactly what Senator Hayden mentioned related to the increase, whether it's social determinants or whatever, the root cause is really a very different topic. There needs to be the opportunity that the local institutions continue this work and figure out exactly what it is that they need to be doing to have an appropriate and timely response. It cannot be something that would go to committee and then we're not acting on it in a manner that really helps protect patients and the staff. So that's the component for me that kind of brings out the passion in my perspective. We need to have action that's timely, and we also have many regulatory agencies that also require this documentation, whether it's the Joint Commission or whether it's the CMS. We need to give a consistent and regular report in order to maintain our license and certification. So that's all I really wanted to add.
I just want to make clear, you have to right now report to whom workplace violence?
We need to keep reports so that we are able to identify any risk factors in our hospital environment to Joint Commission for our certification and for our CMS regulation and how we continue to get paid for the care we deliver.
Thank you. Is there anything further? Any further questions? Senator Nelson, should we wait for the testimony? Senator Nelson?
Oh, sure. I can ask my questions at the end of the
Please introduce yourself. And right now we're about adding to what you said earlier or emphasizing what you said earlier again briefly.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. Again, this is Joy Plowman from St. Cloud Hospital. I just have a couple things to add. OSHA also keeps track of this data, and we are obligated to report that as well. But a couple other points that I want to make is that there are already 90 organizations signed up for the roadmap and that have been working on this since it was implemented in July, and we are well on our way to improving safe care throughout the state of Minnesota. The other point that I want to make is that training, again, needs to be at a local level. I can tell you again, for CentraCare Health and St. Cloud Hospital, we have changed components of our training program every single year based upon the incidents and the trends that we are noting in our environment. And again, it is so important to be able to be responsive to the environment and the changes that are happening as well. We also know that reporting now is underreported. I am concerned about having two different databases, potentially one at a local level at a hospital and another database as well, where, again, we're concerned that people won't report, or, again, they won't report to the hospital where action can take place and they will report to the other database. So I think that that is also an important piece that I would like you to consider as you move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Wieger and Mr. Tolleson, I think that if I can summarize what I think are difficulties that the committee is having with the bill. One is whether or not it's necessary. And I don't know that everybody agrees that it's not necessary. I think, especially for the section of hospital duties where you're describing the obligations of the hospitals to do what was described here. That there's a clear expectation from us and the legislature that be implemented. That's one part of the bill that may have support, and it may not, I'm not certain. But it certainly doesn't have support if we don't change the language D about the methodology for seeking extra help when there is a crisis or when it's anticipated that there's a crisis on the behavioral risk analysis. There's serious concern about the penalties without being excessive, and maybe that needs to be worked through or thought through again. And some review about making certain that the goal that you have for the database is if it can be met in another way without an extra complication that seems to need a little more conversation among the stakeholders. I don't know for certain you can put this to a vote with some recommended changes here, or we can lay it on the table and ask you to step away and try to work through some of these issues. And I will commit to you that if you're able to work those things through, we will bring it back up, not with public testimony, but for you to present to the committee some refinement of the bill that you think is responsive to the concerns that you're hearing from the members. Senator Wieger?
Well, Madam Chair, I'll reiterate again, I'm happy to meet with the stakeholders. I had asked of that actually immediately following the earlier hearing. I was told they did not want to get together. If you would like to encourage that, that would be great.
I forgot that Senator Nelson had a question, so I'm going to go to that, and then I'm going to ask if that's the case that people are not wanting to get together to have a conversation about this bill, because that would be very, very disappointing to me.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you very much. I just will put out my questions and concerns that I don't know that they've been addressed yet. I know you mentioned that it seems like we're duplicating what's already done in other places, whether it be OSHA or the 90 organizations that are already working towards this roadmap. But the things that at which I also sense that this seems to be a little like we might be duplicating things in different places, trying to get to a solution here. But the questions that I have are more specific, like why are we just asking the department to look at hospitals in this regard? A lot of these type of issues can happen in nursing homes. I mean, I'll give you an example. When I was visiting my father, actually his roommate slugged me in the face. So I'm just saying a lot of times, and it was quite a Thanksgiving moment when I was visiting my father on Thanksgiving. But I'm saying these type of behaviors oftentimes occur more in nursing homes and folks with some sorts of dementia that often leads to aggression. And so it's interesting that we're just focusing on the nurses here. I think that is really my point there. And then a couple real, I think, logistic things. It appears that the legislation would be kind of like a complaint call-in center, but what happens when there's a lot of different complaints, and we all know we can see an issue and we can witness something happen, but we all have a different view. You know, the story about the elephant, one man touched the tail, one man touched the tusk, one man touched the ear, they all thought they were touching a different animal. And so when it comes to events, especially events with that can happen so quickly, different people are going to see different parts of that, and yet it seems that this bill would lead to multiple complaints, and instead of maybe there should be an incident complaint instead of a lot of different concerns. And then the last question is even more specific, and it gets to the last part of the bill, and I'm thinking maybe this is an oversight, but the bill actually says that a hospital's license could be subject to suspension or revocation if the hospital did not adequately address a healthcare worker's request for additional staffing. And that seems like there's probably a more than just, I would hate for a hospital to lose its licensure because there was a request for more staff and for some reason it was denied. Maybe it was a good reason that it was denied. So I just think that the language here has a lot of work left to be done. And I'm hoping that this incident, maybe one incident instead of a variety of complaints would be one avenue to consider.
I think that a way that you could simplify this process of a database for complaints is that you would have to implement an incident report in this situation. So you could submit an incident report to the department and have that maintained as a record or something like that, rather than a more significant or complicated process, because it would help any data collection and study that might need to be done on workplace violence. So I'm hoping you're hearing these as suggestions. I think that we're all over the place here, some not thinking it's a necessary bill, some of us liking at least the components that say that there has to be an implementation of some of the great practices that are occurring in some of the hospitals. There's some anxiety about the degree of penalty that's here without due process or to make sure due process is in place. The incident report, rather than a whole new lengthy set of reports, might not have to duplicate that process. Please look at that. And changing the language, is, because you're hearing come up this concern about this is about staffing and not about seeking additional supports during a situation in which violence is erupting. So that language needs to be clarified so that's clear for people who are anxious that this is moving into a staffing battle again. I do want to follow up on this, that Senator Wieger has indicated that an effort's been made to try to work out some issues as it relates to this bill. I'd like to hear from the stakeholders who are here in the room who have an interest that are, Ms. Krinke, if you'd be willing to come. I know that sometimes when people don't want something to happen, they just don't meet, and that won't work in this case, so I'm hoping that that's not the case.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. After our hearing today, Senator Wieger asked if we could meet this afternoon, and there were two bills up in the House. The House Health and Human Services Committee meets at 2:45, and the Hospital Association had another bill that we were advocating for that was one of our bills that was up this afternoon. As well as another, there were two bills up this afternoon that we were tracking. I had no time this afternoon, and I really would like to involve, believe it or not, the Minnesota Department of Health and some of the others that have worked on the roadmap. So I am committed and happy to continue to work on this, but I think we need the Minnesota Nurses Association, the Minnesota Hospital Association. I think the Long-Term Care Association should be involved as well as the Department of Health. So we are committed to continue to work on this issue. We've introduced another bill regarding violence in the workplace. We are very concerned about this issue as well. As you've heard from the testimony, we are concerned about the staffing and the linkage to staffing. And it was noted by several people, it's not just about nurse staffing, it is about security staffing, de-escalation training. There are so many facets and different components of this. And so I think we need to bring the stakeholders back together. I liked Senator Sharon, your idea about one incidence report instead of having multiple ones filed. I don't even know how the Department of Health would investigate multiple reports on the same incident. It could lead to a lot of confusion by the department, but I'd like to get their input on that as well. So,
I think, is there somebody else who wanted? I think then that I would encourage that this be laid on the table for that conversation, but I will say this to the author, that I'm willing to have you bring a bill back, and if it doesn't have anything else in it except an expectation that you have under Section Subdivision 3, Hospital Duties, as it relates to the implementation, because the nurses are not wanting to wait around for another year's conversation on this issue, so that if we can help send a message that hospitals need to do what these great reforms have done, I'm willing to put that in front of this committee for a vote, even if it doesn't include some of these other elements. So at least bring that portion back for consideration this year.
Thank you. Madam Chair, we'll have a progress for you no later than next Monday.
Thank you very much. So we will lay Senate File 1071 on the table. Senate File 1275, Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I know that we have been here quite a long time, so I'm going to be brief in my comments. I have Senate File 1275, the creation of a healthcare innovation task force. Senate File 1275 will allow Minnesota to continue to build on its history of implementing innovative approaches to health care reform. We've made great progress in Minnesota in making health insurance more affordable and accessible for people who could not get coverage before, but there's still gaps. This task force will look at innovative strategies to continue to implement health care reform, including accessing the current status of health care coverage and where are the gaps, reviewing new purchasing models, developing new strategies to address disparities, looking for new ways to simplify and streamline public health care programs, and proposing reforms that are allowed under the Section 1332 waiver. The makeup of the task force is broad and inclusive. One of the things I do want to say before I introduce Ms. Doyle is that I have started to get more folks to come that says that they might want to be a member of the task force. We tried to kind of just get a general group of people that we thought would be well. I hope that we don't spend a tremendous amount of time with testifiers coming up to say that they want to be involved. I'm more than willing to entertain that conversation if this bill is to move forward. But I know that you just often in these task force and other issues, you're going to leave somebody out or you can't include everyone. So with that being said, Madam Chair, I have Liz Doyle, Deputy Director of Take Action Minnesota, who can speak more to the provisions of the 1332 waiver.
Welcome. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Great. Thank you very much. My name is Liz Doyle, and I'm the Associate Director of Take Action Minnesota. So I just wanted to speak, thank you, Madam Chair, for just briefly about what the 1332 waiver is that this task force is intended to talk about. So the 1332 waiver is a part of the Affordable Care Act, has been since its inception. It does not allow the waiving of everything related to the Affordable Care Act. There's a specific set of portions of the Affordable Care Act that can be waived through the Section 1332 waiver. Those include things like the essential health benefit package, the cost-sharing reductions, the premium assistance, penalties for employers, and the individual mandate. There are a set of things that cannot be waived through the 1332 process, and those include most of the private market provisions of the Affordable Care Act, including things like charging higher premiums, denial of coverage for pre-existing conditions. Those things do not fall under the 1332 waiver, just to be clear about that. There are one set of regulations that have come out for the 1332 waiver. They are quite broad and relate only to its process. So we are expecting we'll get a subsequent set of regulations from the federal government that will be more specific. It is also true that the 1332 waiver, any state who submits a waiver, there are some standards that are set within the Affordable Care Act in order to receive federal approval of that waiver. So those standards include things such as any waiver must provide benefits that is at least as comprehensive as the essential health benefits package. Cost sharing and coverage must be at least as affordable as in the current marketplaces. At least a comparable number of individuals should be able to access coverage, and it should not increase the federal deficit. So those are the parameters of the 1332 waiver. Again, the intent of this task force, as Senator Hayden mentioned, is to provide an opportunity and a forum for a group of stakeholders to take into consideration what opportunities may we have in Minnesota to take advantage of the 1332 waiver in order to streamline coverage, improve affordability in some cases, look at changes to the delivery market, those kinds of things. So I will stop there. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Doyle. Are there others that would like to testify? Did you have anyone else wanting to testify, Senator Hayden?
Madam Chair, no, this is my only testifier.
Okay, great. Is there anyone else wishing to be heard on this bill? Seeing no one, it's time for the committee to ask any questions they might have on the bill. Senator Eaton and then Senator Lori.
Senate, thank you. Senator Hayden, can I be on the task force?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Eaton, we'll take that under consideration.
We'll consider it. Is that really your question?
Otherwise.
Okay. Seeing no questions, Senator Hayden, would you like to make a motion?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 1275
State and local government
to be passed and moved to state and local government.
Thank you very much. On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. And the motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Let this be a model for the up-and-coming bills.
Okay, get them on there, bro.
If you'll remember, Senator Marty told us that there's some kind of a grand opening, a red carpet event tonight for toxic. What is it? Toxic hot seat. It's a grand opening.
Madam Chair, I can give it to you in 30 and a half seconds.
He said he'd be here in 30 and a half seconds.
I can get it to you in 30 and a half seconds.
The oh, the name of it. Okay.
You can watch it online.
Anyway,
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
Toxic Hot Seat, hosted by Marty and Howe. And it starts at 6:30 at the, I don't know where it is.
Okay, anyway.
At 300 SOB.
Okay, so that's
bring
where
popcorn.
That's where Senator Martin, free popcorn. All right. We are in recess. No. All right. So Senator Marty is not here, and so we're going to move ahead and begin a hearing on Senate File 934. Senator Franzen is saying, welcome, Senator Franzen, to the committee. Hello, Senator Franzen. May I just ask you here, we're trying to get through quite a lengthy agenda this evening, but we want to provide enough time for testimony to help us understand what the bill is about, what it's trying to achieve. So because there is a lengthy list of people wanting to testify, I would like you to, I'm sure that you've already talked to your testifiers. We're going to try to give an even amount of time for both perspectives or all perspectives for those supportive and those who have concerns. And so we're going to hold the testimony, I think, to about 15, maybe 20 minutes per side, hopefully 15. And I don't know if you'll be able to accomplish that, but I hope that you will do the best you can to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will keep our end of the bargain with our 15 minutes. Good afternoon, and Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here with you today, particularly because it's Minnesota Medical Association Day at the Capitol, and you probably have seen the white jackets floating around advocating for this bill at Senate File 934, among other priorities. Senate File 934 deals with prior authorization for medications. I first heard about the challenges with prior authorization during a legislative interim, and at that time I heard from physicians that the prior authorization process was time-consuming, frustrating, and costly. For physicians, the prior authorization process takes time away from treating their patients. It's estimated that a physician spends on average 2.8 hours per week, nursing staff spends 16.9 hours per week, and clerical staff spends 5.6 hours per week on a prior authorization on behalf of their patients. That equals to an average of $64,859 annually per physician alone. And if you consider the prescribing physician population in our state of roughly 12,000, That's over $800 million annually spent on prior authorization bureaucracy just on physician side. It became evident to me that we needed to address this issue. The prior authorization legislation in front of you is a step in improving the ability of patients getting the right medications to treat their conditions. The proposed legislation calls for improving transparency of medication coverage, limit changes to such coverage during an enrollment year, ensuring ongoing coverage when patient transitions to new insurance policies, and use prescribing data to support improved prescribing practices instead of to delay patient care. With this bill, Minnesotans will have an easier time receiving prescribed medications. The bill removes barriers from the time a physician prescribes a medication to a patient to the time it takes a patient to pick it up at the pharmacy. Certainly, pharmacy benefit managers and insurers have a role to play, but we have heard countless stories where inconsistent and unclear rules get in the way of patients receiving the care they need when they need it. While the intent of prior authorization was to provide oversight and control cost, it is often applied to medications that don't need to go through the prior authorization process. Just today, I heard from a physician from the Mayo Clinic who was undergoing a prior authorization process for a $4 generic. And it's not atypical to also have to go through a process for medications like insulin, which diabetic patients need on a daily basis. This legislation would not only would not do away with prior authorization. It actually, when used effectively, prior authorization plays a critical role in providing oversight and the necessary tools to relieve pain and to deliver results. Most prior authorization reviews end with the prescriptions being approved anyway. So what physicians want to now know is have a clear set of rules. In Minnesota, there are more than 1,000 medications that would likely be subject to prior authorization, and only 6 had the same rules with Minnesota insurers. And data analyzed by the Minnesota Medical Association found almost no similarities among insurers in terms of the drugs they subject to prior authorization requirements, which suggests that authorization requirements are not being used to steer patients to the best medications for patients on the basis of clinical rationale. We look forward to the day of automatic electronic prior authorization as the norm starting in first of the year of 2016. But even then, we will not have dealt with the inherent problems with the lack of transparency and standardization in the current process. We need to address these issues today to ensure patients get the medications they need when they need it. In summary, the legislation is about improving access to care, especially for those with chronic conditions. First, it would provide for greater transparency by ensuring easy-to-understand drug coverage information is available not only to physicians but also to their patients. For example, if a drug is not covered, physicians and patients should be provided with an alternative drug that is covered. Second, it provides for a standardized and streamlined process for obtaining necessary medications in a timely manner, by requiring a uniform form for prior authorization to be used. The most important thing this legislation does, it removes barriers from the time a physician prescribes the medication to a patient to the time it takes a patient to pick it up at the pharmacy. It would also free up time for physicians to take care of more patients. Third, it allows for individuals to make an informed decision when selecting a health plan because they can count on their drugs being covered for the plan year and know what the cost-sharing arrangement or the out-of-pocket costs will be. Patients will have a better understanding on what medications their insurers cover without having to worry about unforeseen cost. Fourth, it provides the stability and predictability that patients and the physician can count on by limiting the medications from being constantly changed based on cost versus meeting patient needs. This legislation aims to strike a balance between patient safety and efficient access to treatment. This debate should not center solely around cost. Yes, we want drugs to be affordable, but we also do not want to have that at the expense of patients that don't get their medication on time, ending up in the emergency room or, worse yet, in the criminal justice system. A consistent medication schedule is key to ensuring quality care and treatment. Prior authorization can upset this schedule, threatening the health of the patient through delays in obtaining medication and disruptions in ongoing therapy. Senate File 934 puts the patient first in ensuring that they have access to the medications and the care that they need without having to go through unnecessary obstacles. Streamlining the prior authorization process would increase the time physicians can actually spend with their patients. And the prior authorization deserves more clarity and limiting disruptions to medication therapies results in better quality care for all. With that, Madam Chair, I have a few testifiers that will briefly also provide some testimony with me. I have Dr. George Shep Oyster from the Minnesota Medical Association.
Welcome, Dr. Shep Oyster.
Very good.
Shep Oyster. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is George Shep Oyster. I'm a geriatrician. I practiced over 30 years in the St. Cloud area doing full-time geriatrics now for the last 7 or 8 years. And I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association. The MMA strongly supports Senate File 934, and we really appreciate Senator Franson's leadership on this, what we feel is an important issue. There are two major goals for this bill, and though they are fairly simple, they're extremely important. It's about ensuring that patients both understand their prescription drug benefits and that they then are protected from delays and disruptions in obtaining those medications. It turns out that several of the bill's provisions actually are already current requirements under Medicare prescription drug or Part D program. We believe that it is a common sense strategy to extend the protections that are currently available to Medicare enrollees to all Minnesotans who are insured through either commercial payers or the Medicaid managed care plans. To kind of introduce the concept as we see it as physicians, I wanted just to give you one case example. And I would have many each week that I could tell you about how it frustrates me and my practice, but I'm going to talk to you about a case from the patient and family perspective that I had heard about. This mother has an adult child in her late 20s with complex mental health illness, and when she's not given some of her medications, it impacts her behaviors. Her diagnoses include, among many things, attention deficit disorder, and the particular medication that was the issue was the stimulant medication that she is controlled on very well most of the time. The problem is when she isn't appropriately medicated, she starts to make bad choices, and one of the bad choices was to steal. And then what happened was her drug was no longer, it needed to be prior auth, it didn't get done. She didn't get her stimulant medication. That keeps her from keeping on schedule, and she missed the hearing. And as a consequence of a failed prior authorization process, spent most of a week in jail from missing a hearing. And so prior authorization that doesn't work has huge impacts socially, financially, and in many areas. So medications can provide life-saving therapy for thousands of Minnesotans, particularly for those with chronic and complex diseases. They can prevent hospitalizations and emergency room visits and deterioration of health. Yet we know that medications are not always used as prescribed. For example, for some patients with chronic illness, we know that approximately 50% of them do not take their medications as prescribed. And that was published in a study by Brown in Mayo Clinic Proceedings. This problem of not taking medications as prescribed comes with enormous cost to the healthcare system in terms of increased morbidity and death, and is estimated to cost somewhere around $100 billion a year. That was published in a study in the New England Journal of Medicine. So the causes of medication non-adherence are, of course, complex, and the results are numerous, and results from numerous factors. But this bill will address some of the real and tangible barriers to medication use. That is, the disruption in medication therapy that occurs as a result of frequent changes in medication coverage and the delays that are associated with prior authorization processes that are inconsistent, confusing, and often illogical to both the patient and the provider. So let me try to explain how I've come to understand this prior authorization process over the last couple years. Most insurers and their pharmacy benefit managers define their preferred list of covered medications, which is then known as their formulary. They then work to negotiate discounts and rebates with the drug manufacturers for the drugs on their formulary list to help them manage drug spending. And so, thus far, this is all a good thing. However, these formularies can change at any time, meaning that there is almost no predictability for patients or for physicians in knowing what medications will be covered, and therefore, more importantly, how to ensure ongoing access when getting prescriptions refilled. So this means that at times patients may be choosing insurance coverage with an expectation that a drug will be covered, only to find out a few months later that it's been dropped from the formulary. So now it has to be on the formulary. Then the next, within the prior authorization process, there are various requirements that are applied to some of these medications to further manage their use, so that the insurer or the pharmacy benefit manager approval must then be granted before a patient can actually obtain their particular medication from the pharmacy. This prior authorization process can take several forms. First, a physician may need to prove to an insurance company or a pharmacy benefit management company that the prescribed medication is medically necessary for the care of the patient. That's called medical necessity. Second, an insurer may cap the quantity of medications covered in a defined time period and then require the physician to seek approval if they wish to exceed that cap. We call that quantity limits. Third, under step therapy requirements, an insurer will make a patient take medications in a particular order. They have to fail on one drug before they can move on to the next. Finally, five, there are challenges of trying to request approval for a drug that's not even on that formulary but is felt by the physician to be needed to treat the unique conditions or personal characteristics of this particular patient. Prior authorization is often touted as a tool to ensure quality and safety of prescribed medications, and it should be. But I can tell you, as it currently is structured, that is not how we physicians experience it. Rather, it often feels like a painful, frustrating barrier imposed by a bureaucracy that has no clue about the patient that I'm caring for who's sitting in front of me at this time. In the fall of 2014, we reviewed formularies found on public websites from six Minnesota payers and identified 1,000 medications, as Senator Franson mentioned. Some of the drugs with authorization requirements were expected, like expensive biologics. Others, however, were bewildering and included medications like low-cost generics, standard therapies in existence for decades, and truly life-saving medications like asthma inhalers, which is a complaint of almost every doc that I talked to. The greatest surprise, however, is that from that list of more than 1,000, as was mentioned, only six of them were common amongst all the payers. It seems to me that science and the evidence that comes from that science that informs medication prescribing shouldn't be based on a patient's insurance. So if prior authorization were truly quality and safety, about quality and safety, we should have found, I think, more similarity in its use across the payers. So it was these results that finally convinced us that legislation was going to need to be a necessary step to try to address this variation and its impact on our patients. And let me take a moment just to talk a little bit about costs. I'm not an expert on costs, but several opponents of this bill have expressed concerns that this bill will increase health care costs. Although the MMA disputes that conclusion, we would urge you to think more comprehensively about health care costs and to recognize the cost impact of the current prior authorization process. Physicians as well as pharmacists incur significant administrative costs in completing and submitting prior auth requests that are not reimbursed, costs approaching nearly $68,000 per physician per year, and that was a study out of Health Affairs in 2009. More importantly, when authorizations are delayed or denied, additional medical costs have been well documented in research findings, such as when a patient has to rely on a less effective or maybe more toxic to them or more expensive medication that then leads to more physician visits and lab visits and ER visits and time in jail in the case that I told you about. One vivid example is in a study looking at the use of emergency services among schizophrenic patients after a cap was placed, cap being one of those prior authorization processes. A cap was placed on the number of prescriptions that was put in place. This study found that extra spending on emergency care outweighed the drug savings by a factor of 17 to 1, a study by Sumerai in the
Senator
New England
Heaton.
Journal.
Excuse me. Did you have a question?
Oh, I just had a quick question. I know that the testifier is very thorough, and it appears that he's anticipating what all of the questions that might be asked. I also know that we're in a policy committee, and I wanted to make sure that we stayed kind of clear on the general policy if this bill should go forward. I imagine it would have to go to Senator Lori's committee, so I don't want to be rude and cut you off, but I do want to make sure that we're spending enough time hearing from all the testifiers, and though you're doing a thorough job anticipating what I think the opposition would be, I just wonder if we can narrow this to the policy aspects of this, and if it goes forward, Senator Lori can deal with the cost issues.
I don't have much more to offer. Add.
Excuse me, I could not hear you.
I'm sorry. I'm pretty much done. I don't have really much more to add.
The essence of the last portion of your testimony was talking about that there is a fiscal, there is a financial consequence to the complexity that there is in prior authorization.
Correct.
And you were giving examples of that. Okay, thank you. We're running up to the end of our time. Does this complete your testimony?
Madam Chair, I do have a couple more that I don't know. There's some testimony that has been submitted in writing, so if Michelle Atte is still here from Walgreens, maybe she can briefly express their position on this bill. And then we have Kelly Carlson, who's a patient from the Arthritis Foundation, and Sue Abderholden from NAMI, who may also have submitted testimony in writing, so maybe it's a matter of just reiterating that testimony and pointing out to their position.
Thank you. And to the testifiers, let's see. I know much of the testimony is about the importance and the need for reform in the prior authorization, and perhaps some examples that you'll all be giving about that. And, you know, I would encourage you not to have to make that case over and over again with your time, because we would want to be sure that you want to be sure the committee understands what you're trying to do in the bill itself, what the bill does do to fix the problems that you're describing.
Madam Chair, as well, I do have an amendment that I forgot to move or have the committee move, so at whatever point you'd like for that to happen, I just wanted to make sure it happens because it made substantial changes to the bill.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Atte.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Michelle Atte. I'm a pharmacist with Walgreens, and I'm also a member of the Minnesota Pharmacy Association. My testimony will be brief. I wanted to share that as a pharmacist, what we see firsthand, how the current prior authorization often adversely affects our patients' health by creating the delays that the patients that need to receive their medications and they don't receive them in a timely fashion. Both Walgreens and the Minnesota Pharmacy Association support file 934. I'd like to just share briefly three examples of what we've seen in a pharmacy to illustrate why this bill is important to our patients in Minnesota. We've had several patients recently that were started on hepatitis C medications, and the insurance plan covered these medications for the first month and then required a prior authorization for all future refills. This is an antiretroviral therapy, and if you discontinue the treatment before the 12-week duration, it can lead to treatment failure and also potential resistance to future therapy. We currently have patients that need their fills by the end of this week, and we're still waiting for an insurance plan to make a decision on the prior authorization. Another large problem that we see is with transition fills. We have a pharmacy that fills a lot of medications for patients with HIV. And when they go to fill their medication, it goes through fine the first time. And then when we go to fill the refill, it comes back that they need a prior authorization. And what happens in many of these cases is the insurance company has sent a letter to this patient telling them that the medication is going to require a prior authorization. Oftentimes, these patients are transient or don't understand what that means, so they show up in our pharmacy and weren't unable to fill their medications. So an important part that the bill does address is this communication needs to occur directly to the provider so that we can help patients get the medications that they need. My third and final example is of a patient that we had who has rheumatoid arthritis, and each year they require a yearly prior authorization. We started working on the prior authorization 3 weeks before the patient needed their medication, and the plan consistently delayed the process and asked for additional information that wasn't requested up front initially. And because of this, the patient was off of their therapy for 3 weeks, developed intense pain and stiffness, and had to be hospitalized due to this. So the current prior authorization process as a healthcare professional and provider does create a barrier to us providing patients with access to the medications that they need when they need them, and we do see that this produces adverse effects on the patient's health, and that's why we support the bill.
Thank you. Senator Franzen?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do have Carolee Carlson, so I'd like to have a few minutes to have a perspective from a patient from the Arthritis Foundation. And if we have time, I may perhaps just have Sue Abderholden briefly. I've seen her done brief remarks before, so I know she's able to do that here too.
Hi, I'm Kelly Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Arthritis Foundation.
Could you pull your microphone forward, please, Ms. Carlson? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kelly Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Arthritis Foundation, and I'm a patient. In my senior year of high school, I was diagnosed with psoriatic arthritis, which is an autoimmune disease in the most simplest of terms. It means my immune system is attacking my joints and my skin. Autoimmune diseases are really tricky. There isn't a one-size-fits-all treatment plan for all patients. I've been on a number of different medications, from non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs to biologics to chemotherapy treatments. And in recent years, I've been lucky to find a cocktail of these medications that have been working wonderfully for me and have led me to lead a relatively normal life. Unfortunately, a few years ago, when my mom's insurance got cut short and we switched to my dad's insurance, methotrexate, which is a staple of my treatment plan, was not covered by our new insurance plan, but we did not know about that. For 2 months, I was off of methotrexate, and luckily I have a wonderful doctor who went through all the paperwork, and I got it back. But in those 2 months, I spent a couple days in the hospital because I was in, I had a high fever and in debilitating pain to the point where I couldn't even move my neck. Obviously, being in the hospital is a lot more expensive than just taking my medication. Recently, I've turned 26, so I had to go shop for my own insurance plan. And I found that to be, as somebody who's relatively savvy with a computer and can figure out what I do and do not need out of an insurance plan, I found it very challenging to find which plans actually covered my medications and which ones didn't. As a patient, I think it's really important for those of us who know what treatments work for us to know, to have the transparency for us to figure out what plans do and do not work for us. It should be a much simpler process.
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Abderholden, is she prepared to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. I'll just make a couple of points. One is that I wish, actually, the amendment went far enough and outlawed step therapy for antipsychotics. It is so difficult to find the right medication with symptoms or with side effects that you can actually move forward with, and to start with the cheapest, oldest medication is really not best practice. We know that treatment adherence is even more of an issue, so you really want to be engaging with that patient to try to figure out what will work. You know, as many of you know, I have family members who live with depression and anxiety, and we've experienced all of these things, trying to find the formularies online to try to make sure that my family member's medication is covered has not been easy, so the transparency piece in the bill is important. The other part is not changing the formulary in the middle of the plan year. That happened to us, and unfortunately, my daughter lives out of state, and so I'm on the phone trying to figure this all out, you know, juggling all of these numbers, and that was not an easy thing, and you never want to see your 22-year-old, you know, starting to fall apart in another state. And then the third thing is, now I was hearing so much I forgot. I want to underscore how difficult prior authorization can be and how that length of time that goes on can make it really difficult. We often see prior authorization for things like injectables for antipsychotics, and then it takes a long time, and yet we know if someone's actually willing to do an injectable, that's much easier on them in terms of remembering those different medications and staying well. And we know that states that have used Medicaid, under Medicaid, have used a lot of prior authorization and step therapy. We found that their inpatient use was actually higher because they're not able to take those medications. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think that I think we'll allow the next set of testifiers to communicate their concerns about the bill, if that's all right, Senator Franzen.
That's fine, Madam Chair. The only issue is we did make substantial changes to the to the bill, so I want to make sure that we're talking about the amended bill versus the original as introduced bill.
Okay, this is a delete everything amendment. Tony moves the A2 amendment. Excuse me. Senator Laurie, it's getting late.
ladies and gentlemen.
I'm sorry. Senator Laurie moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
Madam Chair, did
you want to go through the bill at all and describe
it? I can.
I
know that council has a review for the bill, so that could be easy. I mean, I can highlight some sections of the bill briefly.
Do the committee members feel that that's necessary? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that a full walkthrough is necessary, but a lot of us have been visited about some of the controversial pieces. If you could review how your amendment dealt with those controversies or moved based on input you heard from stakeholders.
Great. Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the main issue we had when we first introduced the bill and we heard from stakeholders across the board that there were issues with Section 18, and that has been completely removed in the author's amendment. So it was it would have greatly restricted the ability to do any prior authorizations according to stakeholders. So that is now gone, and it also was the biggest fiscal impact in the bill. So that was the biggest heartburn. We completely took off the bill. A few other sections deal with timelines. You've heard in my testimony and others testifying to the different timelines in this bill. From the original, we've actually broadened the timelines, basically cutting them in half from what they originally was. So for an expedited review for emergency cases, the time is shortened from a current 72 hours in statute to 36 hours. The original 72 hours came about in the 1990s when the claims were actually in paper, and now I also mentioned in my testimony it's moving towards electronic. So there's certainly more argument that we're able to process them in less than 72 hours if we're doing them automatically as of 1/1/2016. We also shortened timeframes for the appeals of a denied claim from 30 days to 15 days. So that's another change, an expedited appeal from 72 hours to 36 hours. So everything in statute is basically being cut in half, and that's an amendment because in our original bill we had tighter time frames. So we're working with stakeholders to be reasonable in terms of having some changes moving in the direction of more of efficiency dealing with the new technology, but also because of we're hearing so much from patients having issues getting their medications on a timely basis. We've added some definitions for quantity limits and step therapy on the bill to make sure that we are all in agreement with how those should move forward and add more clarity for providers and all stakeholders and in terms of what those reference and what they are defined as. And then I'm trying to figure out what other areas would be. There are still some sections that require, there are new sections to require protections for consumers, requiring health plans to disclose what drugs are covered at what cost sharing requirements, so patients know what kind of agreements they're bargaining for. And then, like we mentioned as well, there would be no changes in a plan year of your formulary if you're accepted a plan year for your formulary. It should not change more than once in that plan year. There's a transition period for patients who are on established drugs and are forced to change because of a health plan changes. There's some transition periods to make sure that we don't take patients off of drugs and put them on a different one abruptly. We also established an advisory committee under the health department to review trends in prescription drug coverage and formulary design to make sure we're keeping up with the new trends and ability to access more efficient drugs and more affordable drugs. Those are the main parts of the bill and the changes in the amendment that I think I could highlight at this moment, but if members have any questions in a particular section, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thank you for that. I think we will go to the next set of testifiers. And people can write their questions down. We'll bring people back as needed. Who we have listed here is Bentley Graves from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Is Bentley in the room? We have a number of testifiers, so we're going to hope that you will be efficient. So we'll have till about 7:30 for this next group of testifiers. We'll begin with Mr. Graves.
Madam Chair, members, actually, my name is Dave Dietrichs. Bentley Graves asked if he could go after me. So I'm Dave Dietrichs. I'm with Express Scripts.
Say your name again.
Dave Dietrichs. I believe Paul Cassidy is listed on your agenda.
Oh, okay.
I was actually able to make the hearing, so I am testifying in his stead.
Thank you, Mr. Dietrichs. Continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So I work for Express Scripts. We're a pharmacy benefits management company. We're headquartered in St. Louis, Missouri, although we have a large facility in Bloomington, Minnesota, with approximately 2,000 employees. Our company's mission statement is simply to make the use of prescription drugs safer and more affordable. And we do that for our clients, who include health plans, organized labor unions, Fortune 500 companies, and government entities. Our largest client is the United States Department of Defense. So all of our nation's military personnel, both active and retired, here and around the world, receive their prescription drug benefit from Express Scripts. We also have numerous clients throughout Minnesota. And we provide the pharmacy benefit for 85 million Americans in this country. We are here today in opposition to both the bill as well as the amended version of the bill that's before us. Before I continue with my comments, and I'm just going to talk about some of the specifics in the amended bill, I do want to predicate my statement with this. Our clients designed their own benefit, and then we are tasked with administering the benefit that they design. Our clients are very sophisticated purchasers, health plan companies, Fortune 500 companies. They often bring in consultants to work with them when they design their request for proposal before we bid on their business. They know exactly the type of benefit that they want to design for us to administer to suit the unique needs of each one of their clientele. That's probably why you were hearing some complaints earlier about a lack of uniformity across the PA process with different health insurers and with different companies. Each company has different needs. Each company has different workforce needs. And so, therefore, as each company designs its own benefit, you're going to have some variations. So prior authorization is used to manage the utilization of drugs that pose safety risks, have high potentials for off-label and experimental use, as well as when dosages are prescribed at levels that exceed the highest FDA-approved dosage levels. These types of bills undermine formulary and drug management tools and can essentially create rubber stamps for approval, as opposed to allow for meaningful review of different prescriptions that are given to patients. And as a side note, this legislation actually would have a nice benefit for brand drug manufacturers, because a lot of times lower cost generic alternatives would be turned away and then the brand drug would be prescribed in its stead. I do want to give one example about the off-label usage, and I actually got this from my chief pharmacist before I came here today. He said, medications are not only approved for FDA-approved uses, but are also covered when there is sufficient data or literature to support their use. A good example of our prior authorization criteria is around human growth hormone. Our policy approves for FDA-approved uses only, but we do not allow coverage when the medication is used for cosmetic or performance-enhancing purposes. So prior authorization does serve a purpose. From what I can understand in working with my PA team, our company adjudicated approximately 1.2 billion transactions last year at pharmacies across the country, and approximately 1% of those were subject to prior authorizations. Now, to the heart of the bill, there's a few things I wanted to touch on. First, beginning on page 12, line 12.25, it says a health plan company may remove a brand name drug from its formulary or place a brand name drug in a different benefit, in a benefit category that increases an enrollee's cost, only upon the addition to the formulary of an A-rated generic or a multi-source brand.
Senator Lori.
Is this in the amendment?
Yes, it
is.
It's in the amended version.
It's in the
12.25.
That's not what my version of the A2 said, I didn't think. Okay.
It's the A2 amendment. Do you have the A2 amendment?
Okay. Well, go ahead. Just wanted to make sure we were in the amendment.
Okay, 12.25.
No, that's fine. So it says that you cannot move a brand name drug from the formulary or place it in a different benefit tier unless one of two things happens. Either an A-rated generic comes onto the marketplace or a multi-source brand name equivalent. And that means another brand that has generics available to it. It's essentially what we call a therapeutic equivalent. And so I have concerns about this, as do our clients, and I'll tell you why. There are many different types of generics that are given labels by the FDA. Not all generics are given an A rating. There are B ratings. There are Z ratings. There are NR ratings and even NA ratings. A lot of times, these drugs come onto the marketplace, but according to this legislation, we could not move the brand name down from a higher tier to a more expensive tier and replace it with the cheaper generic alternative because it doesn't satisfy this criteria. It also says you can't do it unless
It says that you can't do it in a year. You can do it after a year. Is that correct? Am I understanding?
After a year, that's correct.
So it's saying within a year's period of time.
Right. And my concern, Madam Chair, is simply this. One of the examples that was brought up earlier regarding prior authorization had to do with hepatitis C. We all know that's a very serious condition, and the drugs that treat it are very expensive. Up until December of this year, there was only one brand name drug company that had a product in the market. Gilead had two products, Harvoni and Sovaldi. These drugs are pills that you take. You take one pill for 84 days. Each pill costs $1,000. It's an $84,000 treatment. And actually, according to an article that Reuters published just yesterday, and this was from the New York Times, because of this drug that just came into the marketplace within the last few years, the United States spent 743% more on hepatitis C drugs in 2014 than in 2013. What happened in December of this year is that one of the competitors to Gilead came into the marketplace with another brand product called the Viekira Pak. And because of companies like mine, we were able to negotiate substantial discounts that no longer cost patients and payers $84,000 to treat this condition. In fact, you can treat multiple people with this condition instead of just one. This type of drug, had it not had competition in the marketplace, is going to bankrupt Medicaid agencies, and it's going to force employers to make drastic changes to their formularies. So my guess is, without knowing the facts, that the prior authorization story that was told to you earlier had to do with the fact that a competing product came into the marketplace that was substantially cheaper. A benefit plan wanted to change their formulary to accommodate that, and that is why a prior authorization was put in place, because the Gilead product was substantially more expensive for both the patient as well as the payer trying to afford this benefit.
Mr. Dederich, you've almost used up with as many people who would like to have something to say.
Right.
I'd like you to make one critical point, or
yes, ma'am.
If we have time later, you can come back, but
okay.
I'd like to give
one
others
last
a chance.
One critical point then. Right below that on page 12, it talks about how you can remove drugs from formularies, but only if the FDA or a manufacturer has pulled the product because it's dangerous. My company has a team of pharmacists and clinicians right here in Minnesota, and their job is to evaluate drugs and the repercussions that they can have on people. Back in 1999, there was a really popular drug on the marketplace called Vioxx, and it was a blockbuster drug. And it made a lot of money, and it treated a lot of people with some serious conditions. Our Office of Clinical and Evaluation Team noticed that there were some adverse side effects. And 6 months before the FDA pulled the drug, we pulled the drug off our national formulary. We told our clients this is dangerous, that there are bad indicators. Under this legislation, we couldn't make that type of decision again. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you. Thank you. And I think Senator Benson first and then Senator Marty. Excuse me. Welcome back, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Dietrich, can you help me understand what's the difference between A-rated, B-rated, Z-rated, NR?
Sure.
Because you're contesting that that's not an appropriate restriction to be put in place. I'd like to understand
sure.
what
an
that restriction
A-rated
means.
Means that a drug is generically substitutable. So if a brand is prescribed, an A-rated drug means it's generically substitutable at a pharmacy without consulting with the physician. A B-rated drug, for example, is it means there is another brand name drug in the market that treats the same condition. It's not the same, but they have a generic available. It's called a therapeutic equivalent. It's the difference between a generic substitution and a therapeutic equivalent. Very popular B-rated drug that you might have heard of is phenobarbital. So then there are other drugs that have been on the market for a really long time that don't even have these ratings. These drugs can have NA or NR ratings. They're not even in the Orange Book. They're in other publications that pharmacies look to in doctors' offices like Medispan. And so there are a variety of different drugs that would fall under that would fall outside of these classifications.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair,
Sir, with your last point there, you said under page 12, line 30, they couldn't remove it. And the exception to it, you said about the FDA and so on, but it also has that line about or where an independent source of research, clinical guidelines, or evidence-based standards is issued drug-specific warnings or recommended changes.
Right.
Why would that not cover the concern you had?
Well, we're not an independent source of research, and we don't issue drug-specific warnings. So what we do is we meet with a pharmacy and therapeutics committee, which is consists of doctors that are specialists in their various fields from around the country, and then they make recommendations about what goes on our formulary. So these guys don't issue research. They make recommendations to our national formulary.
Senator Mayor, do you have a follow-up?
Madam Chair, it just seems to me that you're only prohibited from changing it during the contract year. You can change it during that year if you have the independent source of evidence.
Well, and
Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, locking in for the year is the piece also that I think is actually, you know, I mean, maybe we need to have some sort of exceptions, but, I mean, we hear patient after patient after patient coming forward saying that they've done the work to try to figure out what plan that they need to cover the therapeutics that help them stay healthy for the year, only to get 3 months into their year and have it disrupted. They make life-changing decisions based on the research that they do, and you shouldn't be allowed to just change it mid-course. It's a contract term, and, you know, I mean, you can't just be allowed to change patients' understanding.
And mid-term. Madam Chair, if I may also react real quickly to some of the comments. Section 12.25, my understanding is that language comes from already exists in Medicare Part D, so it's not, it didn't come from thin air. It does, it's already part of the industry practice for Medicare Part D. And then sections 12.35 to 36 is exactly included in the amendment to address the issues of if there's a medical necessity and there's a crisis that we need to, it's not safe for the patient that drug can come off. So there's a process through that, and we put that language specifically to deal with the concern that Mr. Diedrichs has pointed out. And if we need to continue to tweak it to make sure that it's intended to do exactly that, address that issue. The other piece of the bill is the advisory committee, which would look at formulary changes. That's another vehicle where, you know, we have people who are in the trade who can actually make those recommendations and evaluate what things are working. So there's a few tools within the bill to address those issues, because if there's a drug that's actually cheaper for the patient and effective, we want that option to be out there for patients. We're not trying to hinder that from happening, but certainly we want predictability for patients, and that's why this bill is moving forward, because we're trying to put those predictability and clear guidelines for patients to be able to make decisions. But we certainly want to have the balance in terms of the flexibility to allow to make sure that it's safe for patients and also effective and affordable.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The point's been made.
Thank you. Then we'll begin with a little further testimony. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Abigail Stoddard. I'm a practicing pharmacist at Prime Therapeutics. So we're a pharmacy benefit manager in Bloomington, Minnesota. We provide the pharmacy benefits for 13 different nonprofit Blue Cross plans, most notably, of course, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, where we cover over 1 million lives in the commercial marketplace that would be affected by this legislation. And so one thing that I just want to make sure the committee understands is really the scope of this issue. Prior authorization and step therapy, which was also mentioned in this legislation, is a key safety tool that I, as a pharmacist and pharmacists on my team, use very sparingly and only when we feel it's necessary. To give an example, on a drug list that I personally manage, I have over 26,000 available products. Of those 26,000 products, only 1,600 of them are subject to any form of prior authorization. So I just want to make sure that it's understood that the frustrations that you're hearing are actually from a that I want to make sure that those frustrations are put in perspective when we think about all of the claims that are paid, all of the medications that patients have free and open access to. Those that are subject to prior authorizations are actually very, very few. That being said, from a pharmacist perspective, we apply prior authorization, number one, above all, for safety reasons. You heard supporters of this bill, in fact, say that we put prior authorization on $4 generics. And, yes, we do that. That's something that I do. And we put them on there because just because a drug is cheap doesn't mean it's safe. Oxycodone, for example, is cheap. Cyclobenzaprine, a muscle relaxant, is cheap. Benzodiazepines are cheap, and I put prior authorizations on all of them because they're unsafe and they're not right for every patient. And so that's ultimately why I, as a pharmacist, do this, and that's why I'm passionate about this. In Minnesota alone, our pharmacists intervened almost 8,000 times on medication therapies that were inappropriate for patients, that put our members at risk for addiction, for falls, for infections, for allergic reactions, any and also number of side effects. So we do this really not to be disruptive, but for safety reasons. And I just want to make sure that that is kept in mind, and that's why we have huge concerns with the overall concept of this bill. It's really turning my number one safety tool on its head over a really small small percentage of claims. And I'll be brief and concise, and with your permission, Madam Chair, I'll just walk through a couple of key points that I want to point out where the safety of Minnesotans is really at risk with some of the language in this bill.
Did you have a question? Yeah. Senator Hayden.
So, Madam Chair and Ms. Stoddard, I just wanted to just kind of get, I mean, I think you've made your point about safety. Do you ever not authorize because of cost?
Not in our benefits, no. I can't speak to everyone's benefits. But what our process is, and it's a proven process that's been accredited by several bodies in our industry, is when we get the information we need from the providers to show that this therapy is safe and appropriate, we approve. And that's what we do. Our number one reason for not approving drugs, in fact, and I think you'll hear testimony to this from others, is insufficient information from providers. Unfortunately, when we don't feel that we're comfortable making a clinical decision, we will deny for further information. And that's our proven process, and that's where our pharmacists are most comfortable.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Stoddard, I want to be clear. You said that you never, ever make a decision because of cost. That's what you said.
I can only speak to the benefits that Prime manages and that I manage, so I
got
say.
It. I just wanted to be sure that that's what I heard, because that's kind of what's going on, and that's kind of what I've heard. Secondly, do you think that your judgment is supersedes the physician's judgment on prescribing?
Madam Chair, I would say that's a very good question, and actually, physicians are experts, are proven experts in diagnosis and in disease, and our profession certainly respects them for that, and we work together. However, pharmacists are the medication experts. Any pharmacist who graduated in Minnesota after 1996 had 4 years of education specific to pharmaceuticals. So I truly believe that pharmacists are the medication experts.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Stoddard, you would say then that your expertise in prescribing medication supersedes our, you have a much better understanding of what patients need than their physician. Is that what you're saying?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Stoddard?
I would say when we have all of the information necessary.
So I'm going to ask you one more time because you're not answering my question. So I don't want to do this to you, but so you're saying that, yes, with all the information having, you believe that your understanding of what a patient needs, you understand that more than what their physician does.
Madam Chair, I would say yes.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
Senator Hoffman, is your question to this point? Because we have about 5 minutes left for the remaining testifiers. So that's important for this for those who are waiting to testify to know.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I can wait till the end because I think it's important that, you know, prior authorization is indeed an issue, and to hear somebody who puts cost factors in front of really a doctor's recommendation, I know lots of people that that's happened to, and I just wanted to make that note for the record that that cost factor should not be part of that. And as you're stepping that up, the doctors know exactly, especially when you're looking at like antispasmodic stuff that only a urologist would know about. Not too many people delve in that world, but that's where I think people need to hear where the doctor knows what's going on. And there's prime examples of that all over the place. So I'm going to wait until the end, Madam Chair, because of what we're talking about.
All right. I'm going to ask for the next testifiers to come forward. They would be, who is here? Oh, thank you, Mr. Graves. For your patience, please be brief and to the point. And then Leota Lind and Catherine Kimmett, please be prepared to come forward. Please begin, Mr. Graves.
I will be brief, Madam Chair. My name is Bentley Graves with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. First of all, I want to thank Senator Franzen. She and Representative Albright, who's the House author, convened a stakeholders meeting on Friday that helped to work out some of these issues, and I think it certainly moved the conversation along, and I want to applaud them for that. I will keep it very brief. At this point in the evolution of this bill, we as a chamber, I think, still have some concerns about the cost issue. And part of that is wrapped up in the debate you've heard here today. I mean, there are some questions about can we take costs out of the provider side. I think our question is can we do that without raising costs on the payer side. And I think, you know, we have authors here that are interested in working towards a solution that gets to both issues without, in our mind, raising costs on the premium side, and that's the solution we'd like to work towards. Before I leave, I'd just like to call the committee's attention to this letter from the Minnesota Health Action Group, which I think very well lays out, you know, some of the overarching cost concerns that come with starting to make changes to prior authorization and utilization review. These are many of the same kind of broad-based concerns that we have about going in and starting to make some of these changes, which is why we want to continue to be part of this conversation and thank the committee for their time this evening.
Well, I appreciate your succinctness. Would Leota Lind and Catherine Kimmett please come to the table and begin your testimony?
Madam Chair,
please introduce yourself. Yes.
Leota Lind, CEO of South Country Health Alliance, here representing the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will try to be very brief. We did include a letter from the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans in your packet outlining some of our concerns. I would just like to highlight a couple of issues that continue to be of significant concern to us. First of all, I would like to thank the author for the changes to Section 18, removing the requirement, the limitation on prior authorization on formulary drugs. That was one of our major concerns. Regarding the changes to the timelines, this is a section that we have significant concerns about and feel that it is extremely broad. The changes as identified in here are proposed changes to Statute 62M, which are the rules governing the prior authorization process, process for appeals and grievances, that is not just related to pharmacy, but is related to all services. So if these changes were included as they are now, it would not just mean that the timelines for how we respond to requests for prior authorization for pharmaceuticals, but it would also impact requests for durable medical equipment, outpatient services that require prior authorization. So we have concern that this is just extremely broad. We also have concerns about the fact that there is a default approval process, and that if the timeline, the decision is not made within the specified timelines, that it just automatically approves the authorization. You've heard from some of the previous testifiers regarding some of the patient safety issues, and that is one of the concerns that we have with that, particularly if the timelines are condensed. And as you heard previously, many times the reason for the denial is because there's insufficient information. So if we're not able to receive that information, it's denied, but there's a default that it automatically approves. That leaves it very open for some of those patient safety concerns that have been identified.
Senator Eaton has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The initial statement that you made about a section that was related to timelines that it didn't just affect prior authorization, could you please tell me where that is?
Actually, it is section 13 and 14. And it's even broader than that. 16 and 17. Yep. Sections 13 and 14, 16, 17. It's the provisions, any of the provisions related to statute 62M.
Thank you.
Thank you. Could you wrap up so we can move to the next testifier, please?
Yes. The other concern that we have is many of these concerns seem to be driven by some of the instances that are happening with commercial products on the market. We fully support the issue of transparency. And many of the things that are identified in here as options needing to be put in place already exist within public programs. And so we just would like consideration to looking at the issues of where those protections are already in place with public programs, that we don't create another rule that either layers on to what we're already doing or creates a duplicate system where we're providing the same information but in different formats to multiple entities.
Thank you. Our final testifier is Catherine Kimmett.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Kimmett. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I'm going to speak really quickly, and I have a handout for the committee members. First of all, I just want to say that we've been talking with representatives from the MMA about this issue since last summer, and we hear the concerns that they've raised. It is not our intent to make things difficult for patients, providers, or pharmacists. We strongly believe that providing health care should be focused on patient safety, efficacy, and cost. But part of the challenge we face is that we have an employer-based health insurance system in this country. Most Minnesotans obtain their health insurance coverage as a benefit through their employer. Typically, employers pay the lion's share of the health insurance premium. And as a result, they have a large say in the kind of benefits that are offered. I'd like to provide some comments about our main concerns with the bill. First of all, I want to say we appreciate Senator Franson removing Section 18. I also want to say that we appreciate the changes on the turnaround times that were included in the amendment. However, we are still very concerned that even within this time frame, if the drug or service is not, we remain deeply concerned that if the shortened timeline is missed, then the drug or service is deemed approved. That's a really difficult thing for us, especially because, as you've heard from other people, the main reason why the prior authorization takes time is we're trying to get missing information from the prescribing provider. Now, we have an e-prescribing law in this state, and that everybody should be using it. I don't think everybody is, but if all prescribers were to use that, that would help and go a long way to reduce those errors and missing information that happens. We shouldn't have handwritten prescriptions anymore. And then coming up on January 1 will be the electronic prior authorization format, and that should also go a long way to help reduce this problem. Again, as the other testifier just mentioned, this bill is much, much broader than just restricting prior authorization for drugs. It would affect all utilization management programs used by health plans. And if the intent is, in fact, to limit this to prescription drugs, then the bill needs to be amended to reflect that, because right now it is completely wide open, which is going to drive a lot of the cost. The bill also applies inconsistently across various insurers and within the state Medicaid program. It would, and as a result, it would still require providers to maintain different processes, and we believe this would still add probably even more confusion for providers and patients. So I think it's actually compounding the problem instead of reducing it. Just a couple more points. The bill would allow prior authorization for Medicaid fee-for-service, but disallow it for all of the enrollees under the managed care state public programs. And that just makes no sense, that the largest part of the state Medicaid budget would remove prior authorization as a tool to be able to control costs and protect patient safety and manage efficacy. Just a couple more things. I've cut out quite a bit of my testimony. I just want to say that in 2014, year over year, national prescription drug spending grew by 13%. That's just the prescription drug spending. In 2014, grew by 13% to $319 billion, with the unit cost of brand name drugs growing by over 15%. This is, you know, nobody likes to talk about cost and the fact that, these drugs are very expensive, but we have to talk about cost because the cost, the cost of health insurance reflects the cost of health care, and we cannot ignore the dramatic increases we are seeing in drug prices. I just want to make one more point, and that is keep in mind that under our current system of how our health care system works, the forces of competition do not work well where the consumer who pays does not choose the drug and the physician who chooses the drug does not pay. The incentives are not aligned here. And this bill is not going to fix that. This is the reality that we're all dealing with. And what we're talking, so in any event, we think that we recognize that this is a problem. We recognize that people are inconvenienced by this. We would like to use this as an opportunity to talk more and work specifically with the MMA and other stakeholders to reduce the number of prior authorization problems. I don't think this bill is the right way to go about it, and for that reason, we continue to be opposed to this legislation, even as amended. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Senator Hoffman, did you have a question, followed by Senator Hayden?
Madam Chair, thank you. A couple of things, and I have many questions, but in the interest of time, I think I just want to let you know I'll wait till the end, but I do want to just stress, here's what I heard. The employees control what those health plans look like. The employer controls that. And number two, that there's different processes. And then number three, that the incentives are not aligned. Yet I guess my question for the HMOs out there is why do we have none of the formularies align up and everybody runs how they do their own business? And it makes absolutely zero sense to me. So if on one hand I hear the industry saying, well, because there's different processes, and yet, Madam Chair, on the other hand, they're saying the incentives are not aligned. Well, then my question, and this is to you, Madam Chair, to maybe pose it to the rest of the world, and I don't want to engage in any conversation due to the interest of time, why aren't they aligned? And that's my question.
Well, I could give you my answer on that, but I think if you – why hasn't this bill proposed an alignment of all of the formularies for all products? Senator Franzen.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, the bill does require the use of a uniform form for prior authorization, which is already allegedly out there but not enforced. So this bill would require it, so that part of having different formularies, because they are different prior authorization, forms. They use the one that's the uniform one, but then they end up adding more requirements to it. So gives away with having a uniform form, defeats the purpose. So this bill will address that. I would say, in terms of the incentives not aligned, the bill does address cost structure, so it's providing transparency in what the cost-sharing agreement is and what's out the out-of-pocket cost that's required to be disclosed for prior authorization medication. So I think the bill does move ahead in trying to provide information out there for patients to make an informed decision and for the doctors as well. So patients will have that information in front of them. They can go to their doctor and say, I want the cheaper drug. It happens already just as it happens reversely. They see a commercial and they want the expensive drug because they think, they see a commercial, whatnot. So it's they're having that conversation with doctor to assume that that's not happening. I think it's simplifying the issue. But I do believe that our bill addresses costs and transparency and those incentives in terms of who's paying. The patient is certainly paying, and that's why we need to have that information as transparent as possible for them to have. And then I know that we talked about the I just wanted to quickly react to a few other times. The broadness of the scope of the bill, it's intentional, too. In your packets, there's a testimony from one of my constituents who gracefully is probably still here, but unfortunately, due to time, I want to be sensitive. Her testimony is in writing, and it talks about how even surgeries and devices, how that particular issue also gets involved in prior authorization and how they had to actually cancel a surgery because they couldn't get the prior authorization in time. So this bill addresses those issues too, and I think they have to be addressed because we're seeing that in that same area as well. So please read that testimony. We just didn't have time to hear from my constituent, Lori Bangard, but certainly provided that for you to have that broader perspective. It's not just about medication. It's a bigger issue, but we're trying to really hone in on the medication side. But certainly we understand it does cover other areas in terms of the timelines.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And quickly, thank you, Senator Franson, for that explanation. Ms. Commit, I actually enjoyed your testimony to the extent that I think you did talk about cost, and your handout really kind of reflects that. Now, from your perspective, it might be about the pharmaceutical companies and the cost that they're having. But when I was pressing Ms. Stoddard, she just absolutely said it didn't have anything to do with cost. And then you kind of came and said, yeah, it actually has a lot to do with cost. So part of what we're trying to wrestle with here, and as Senator Franson moves this bill along, is to try to figure out how do we find that alignment, because, you know, there's testimony in the opposition that said exactly the opposite. One said it was just simply patient care, and we just, you know, we're the experts, and we know no matter what the doctor says, we know what to do. And you kind of came and said, well, you know, that might be true, but let me tell you what it's really about. And you illustrated in this handout, it's really about cost, and we're trying to figure out, you know, how to provide good patient care in terms of prescribing, but we also need to contain the cost because that's what our interest is. So I just think for the record, we just need to know that I'm trying to figure out what it is, or is there something in the middle, because you guys have testified almost completely different testimonies about why you oppose the bill.
Ms. Commit.
And Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, thank you for that remark. I think that from the health insurance industry perspective, we're trying to balance a whole bunch of things: patient safety, efficacy, and cost. We cannot ignore cost. We're the ones who are paying the claims, so we see the dollars flowing through. And frankly, we don't have a lot of leverage with some of these drug companies that are coming with lots of new drugs, but also raising the prices of existing drugs because they can. And that's having a real impact on your premiums. And so I just wanted to be really clear for everyone to understand that this is, it's a balance, and we're trying to strike a balance. It's very challenging. The PBMs help a lot to try to negotiate lower prices for the drugs, but it's an issue that we're all facing. You don't see it on a day-to-day basis because it's part of your overall premium. And frankly, you don't pay the lion's share of your premium. Most people don't pay the lion's share of their premium. Their employer pays for it. So they don't even know. But health insurance is expensive because the cost of care is expensive, and we're seeing the cost of prescription drugs really escalate very quickly.
So, Madam Chair, quickly, I appreciate that, but I would characterize that differently. If I work for an employer and that's what I negotiate, that's part of my overall benefit package. That's part of my salary and my fringe benefits is the work that I do for them. So I do pay for it. I pay for it in my labor. I pay for it in the work that I do. So I know that literally you're saying we don't, but I just think that if we don't change that frame and understand that, you know, if I go to work for you, this is what I negotiate, including my health insurance. That is in the compensation that you pay me in one form or another. You don't need to respond to that, but I just want us to make sure that we're clear.
Did you have a follow-up, Senator Hoffman? I'm sorry if I cut you off, and then Senator Marty.
No, Madam Chair, I don't. But it sounds like, you know, I'm hearing from the HMOs that they're all about cost and that they want alignment and they want to have incentives. And so I'm wondering why they don't sit together as a group, Medica, Health Partners, whoever else is out there, and figure out a pooling, you know, almost like a single-payer type pooling of how these costs are controlling on the prescription medicine. I guess it's more of a statement than anything else.
Thank you. Senator Marty. There we go.
Madam Chair, this sheet showing the pharmaceutical price increases, I like to point out that that's occurring in a system that's growing with the number of PBMs, that's growing in the whole issue, the prior authorization issue we're dealing with. All of those things are going to bring down the cost. You can see what's happening. There are ways of bringing down the cost, and prior authorization, despite all the talk about how it's meant for the well-being of the patient, it's an attempt by some to try and negotiate better prices the way they do it. It's the most Rube Goldberg-esque way of doing pricing, There's no competition in this. All the terminology is even phonies. The average wholesale price isn't an average. It's not a wholesale price. It's just a bizarre market, and the idea that prior authorization is going to address this problem, it's about the most bizarre way to address it. And I think the issue becomes that there are a lot of people who are having specific needs for specific procedures and drugs. And I read Senator Franzen's constituent situation where their surgery and everything had to be scheduled, rescheduled because of it. I guess I see doctors who are asking for prior authorizations for things, and they've got some insurance company guy sitting there looking at a chart and telling them they can't prescribe a certain medication when they haven't examined the patient. They don't know any of this. I mean, I really think we've got to get at these problems, but prior authorization is in place now, and it's not doing the job. It is denying people their care. I think Senator Franzen's bill is a good one, and if it's time, I'd like to move the bill.
We can put the motion on the table, but I'll allow further discussion and questions. I've got to get the number. Senator Marty moves Senate File 934. Be passed as amended and is it referred someplace? Referred to Commerce. Anyway, Senator Benson, you did, and did I see that you had a question?
Time's passed for it, ma'am. Thank you.
Senator Eaton? Or Senator Nelson? I got Senator Eaton here. Is that
I think I'll just
pass. And Senator Nelson, did you have a question?
I have a comment if we are ready to vote. Otherwise, I'll just hold my comment till the end. Are we ready to vote?
Now would be the time for the comment.
Okay, here are my comments.
Now would be the time, because once we vote, we're going to the next bill.
So I think we've all been here a long time. We understand the issues. And I understand the dilemma. Cost is always a factor. I do understand that. But obviously the system is broken. And the fact that patients cannot get the medications they need when they need them, and I started adding up these timelines, it could be weeks and weeks before a patient got the medication they needed, and that can be a life-changing or a life-ending decision. So I think there are real concerns here. I am concerned about the cost of doxycycline going up so much. This is an old drug. This has been around a long time. So why that happened, I don't know. But I would hope that there's still some more work on this bill. I'm going to support it tonight because I think that patient health and safety is at risk, is a concern here. And quite frankly, I appreciate the role of the pharmacist greatly and the invaluable information they give, I never would expect a pharmacist to supersede what my physician has determined is the best course of action. But I do understand Ms. Kmit's concern that cost is invisible to us, and that is an issue with healthcare in general. The cost is invisible to the payer in many respects. And when you're not aware of costs, they do tend to go up. So I'm supporting this bill tonight, but I do hope there's some work on I think there is concern about some of the maybe we need a threshold in there that when a cost increases significantly to a certain amount, maybe that formulary could be changed midterm. But I also understand it's a contract, and I don't know how you change a contract midterm. So I think that's one of the things that needs to be changed, and I'll be supporting this bill tonight.
Okay, thank you. And I would just like to say that I think the system that we've developed is creating the problems. That I understand why you develop a system where there's a second look. You partner with pharmacists with the expertise of pharmacy to take a look at what I can tell you many times as a nurse, partnering with a physician, drawing attention to the physician about the conflicts that might occur between drugs that are being prescribed, and really that consultation is appreciated. So I don't know that I am willing to go so far as to say that I think that the concept of a review in and of itself is wrong, but the amount of time that it takes to do that makes this an unworkable solution for the care of the patient and for the burden on the medical practices to struggle with getting prior authorization. So these time frames that you've already bent a little on, Senator Franzen, they concern me. I think that if you can expediently engage in prior authorization, there may be merit to it. But it doesn't appear that you can do that. And the outcome, the consequence of that, for the gains that it might provide that I've described here, there's gains that come from the procedures that we have in place now, are not really well received by this committee in relationships to its consequence on the care of patients, for their need for the medication, for their consistency for the patient, for the ability of the physician to modify and put together a set of treatments that work for a unique person with a unique set of circumstances. So with that, we'll just call the question. You know the motion. Senator Marty renews. Senate File 934 be passed as amended and referred to Commerce. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
He killed a member of the committee after
all. I was going to go on like this.
We're going back to Senator Marty. Senator Marty is here this evening with two bills, 1379, Public Health Quarantines, and Senate File 1504, E-Health Advisory Committee. Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Which one would you like first?
Whichever is expedient.
Okay. Either one's fine. We'll start with 1379.
Thank you. As you're organizing yourself, may I ask those of you who are here and now leaving the room, would you please take your conversations to the hallway? Because it's very hard for us to hear during the committee, and we have another bill being heard. Thank you very much for your cooperation. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senate File 1379 is a Health Department bill that relates to our quarantine laws, and what we've learned is that the measles outbreaks are getting people concerned, and in some of these cases, it's not the person with measles we're concerned about, but the parent or guardian or somebody who's caring for the person with the outbreak who has to be quarantined as well, and we don't want them to be losing their jobs because of this. This is simply a prohibition on expanding our existing law on prohibiting discipline, discharging, threatening, or penalizing an employee for being quarantined with the person with the disease. And Chris Erisman is here from Department of Health, and we also do have an amendment I'd like to put on it to put the bill in the shape. I'd like the A1 amendment, which I believe is in the packets.
Is this your first stop?
This is the first stop, yes.
And this is an author's amendment? It's not a delete all. So
a delete all.
Senator Marty offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. It passes. Thank you very much.
And I think I've explained the bill. The amendment was simply to clarify the definition of communicable disease. I think that's more technical than anything else, but Ms. Erisman has comments on the bill.
Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Erisman. I'm the Director for Infectious Disease at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I'll just offer a couple of comments.
We're having a hard time hearing you. I'm sorry.
Okay. Is this better?
That's all right. Much better.
Okay. Chris Erisman from the Minnesota Department of Health, Director for Infectious Disease. I just want to make a couple of comments just to explain these two changes. As Senator Marty said, the goal of the first piece is just to make sure that parents or guardians who are caring for individuals, children, perhaps with measles, or even in the case of our Ebola situations, we have 18 children right now that we're monitoring who are under the age of 18, so are in a position where we could have a situation with a minor. And in those cases, we want those parents to be able to care for the child. So even though the child is the individual that would be isolated or quarantined, they do need a caregiver. And so that would address that issue. And then the second piece was just that we had a case of loss of fever, which is a viral hemorrhagic disease, last April. And then with the global Ebola situation, we felt that it was really important that we clarify the isolation and quarantine statute. We currently feel, the Department of Health feels and the Attorney General feels, that we have the legal authority to isolate and quarantine someone who may have Ebola. However, the way that the law is currently written, it does make reference to a disease defined under Statute 144.4172, Subdivision 5, that basically was intended to make sure that we weren't isolating and quarantining individuals who are HIV infected. And that's why it was added at the time. But it does specifically call out that diseases that are primarily transmitted through blood, blood-borne illness, direct or intimate contact, sex, those things would be excluded from quarantine. And clearly in the case of a viral hemorrhagic fever, which is bloodborne or Ebola, we wanted to make sure that we specifically address those illnesses. So really the amendment is to clarify and address that, and then the original part of the change to the bill is just to make sure that parents and guardians are covered. So thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this Bill 1379? Seeing none, is there anyone? Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, just out of curiosity, thank you. Has there been cases, Senator Marty, where someone has been discharged or disciplined for the care of their child or loved
one? Madam Chair, I believe there was one situation that there was an employer with kind of raising that issue the health department was aware of, but I don't think anybody's actually been fired or anything from it. The point is, as we hope we never have to use these quarantine things, or very seldom, but the point is, if so, we want to make sure that the parent taking care of the child is locked in the house just the same as the child is, and the law is there for protecting public health.
It appears there are no further questions. Would you like to move the bill, Senator?
I will, and Madam Chair, I don't think it has to go to finance or anywhere else. It
needs to go to jobs. They asked for it, sorry.
Fine.
So the motion would be to pass as amended and be referred to jobs. That's Senator Marty's motion with enthusiasm. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to go to the Jobs Committee.
I know.
It's been Madam Chair, Senate Bill 1504 also comes from the Health Department. And this bill is dealing with some sunsets on some advisory councils, two of which we're extending. The e-Health Advisory Committee is doing good work. It's in process. We're not done with their work, and so we're asking to extend it six more years. Same thing from the Trauma Advisory Council, which is being extended for a proposed 10 years. And then the third one, the Maternal and Child Health Advisory Task Force, we're asking to remove the sunset on that. That one started, I think, in 1982 or so, has been extended about five or six times already. And maternal and child health issues are not going away. And I know we don't like to remove sunsets, period, but this is one we're going to be doing again. And if we said another five-year one, we'll be coming back then. So the department was asking to extend it permanently, and I think that makes sense. And then I do have an A1 amendment to this bill. And while it'd be an author's amendment, I want to explain this came not from the department. The department provided the language for it. And it came, it was actually an article in a paper one of the last couple of days. Actually, a constituent of mine who started contacting us a few months ago who had a stillbirth, and in doing more work on it, they found a number of questions they were seeing, and we don't think we have very good data collection about this, and so they wanted to create, and I know Senator Limmer has a bill. We have another bill that would create a task force to look at at fetal deaths. And the question is, do we really need a new task force to do that? Maybe so, but I think it seemed more appropriate, and I asked the department, and they thought the Maternal and Child Health Advisory Task Force, which does this sorts of thing, and they often have little subgroups they call together. And so this A1 amendment would be to encourage them, not forcing them to do anything, but to encourage them to take a review of issues related to fetal death and stillbirths, and just to find out if we should be doing more. We're not requiring a report or anything. I can guarantee you if they do pull together a group, there are plenty of parents who have experiences who would like to find out more. Iowa has a task force on this. We think rather than a task force, maybe asking an existing one to take a look at it would be appropriate. So that's why I suggested this instead of coming in and asking for new task force. Just see, they may say, well, this is beyond our scope. We're not requiring them to do it, but I think they'll take a look at it from my understanding.
So Senator Marty offers the A1 amendment to Senate File 1379. Or 1504, sorry.
Do we have the A1 amendment?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Do you have the amendment?
Yeah. Thank you. I do.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And because the department is at the table, I was wondering if they could mention what they do have on stillbirths and their opinion of this A1 amendment.
Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Susan Castellano, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health. We have data. We tend not to call it stillbirth. We call it fetal death data. Fetal deaths are reported to us from 20 weeks forward, and so we do have, I guess you would say, death certificate information on those deaths. We don't have a mechanism by which we gather any additional information on the details of those fetal deaths.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen?
Then, Senator Marty, what is the, I mean, if that information is being collected, this question, I suppose, would go to the department. Do you look at that information to prevent stillbirths?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it does come out annually in our report on vital statistics. There is some information there. Mm-hmm.
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, I guess one of the questions behind this, are you able to speak for the Maternal and Child Health Advisory Task Force, or that's created your, so you're speaking on behalf of the task force created under the Department of Health? And would the task force, are you able to speak to whether the task force would be willing and able to undertake this additional review that's being requested in the A1?
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, yes, I think they would be amenable to this suggestion. If the legislature is interested, I think they would be willing to help with that.
I think that answers the question. Senator Hoffman?
Madam Chair and members, one of the indicators, in 1935, the MCHB, Maternal Child Health Bureau, put into place Title V, Public Health, and the Maternal Child Health Task Force addresses every year that the Title V public health plan is put in place in Minnesota. One of the things that is discussed is the infant mortality. So this would be a natural fly-in for them to take that up, because they're already talking about the indicators. They're challenging all 12 health indicators, the federal health indicators that are there, and that task force is responsible for that.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. This is the A1 amendment, Senator Hoffman. Do you want, or Senator Marty renews his motion to adopt the A1 amendment to Senate File 1504. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you, Senator Marty. Anything further at this time?
Madam Chair, I have Diane Rydrick here to speak to the bill or take questions of whatever you want. Again, it is basically a extension of sunsets and removal of one sunset. And I think the department made some wise choices in trying to figure out which ones we should just extend and which one we ought to move forward on.
Is there any further discussion on the bill?
I suggest a vote.
Seeing none, Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, this bill has to go to state and local, I believe. If so, Madam Chair, I move that the Senate File 1504 as amended be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I forgot we had eight other witnesses.
Okay, can I get my drum, my rim shot out on that one? Hold on here. Let me get this drum going. Here we go. Here we go.
Now we just have Kathy's, I think.
I got it right here, man.
I've been here every night.
Don't play it.
I got it.
I don't think it's me. I'll put my hands up.
I had the LCC. Legislative coordinator. Had that to 8 o'clock.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. I'm here to present Senate File 1292 on non-emergency medical transportation. I'd like to begin by offering the A1 amendment.
Senator Sharon offers the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Thank you very much. This is the last bill of the evening.
Woo-hoo.
You know, and I thought we'd be here a lot longer. I'm sort of pleased with all of us. But the non-emergency medical transportation is a service that is provided for people who are on medical assistance, and they have as a right underneath that program to be able to get appropriate transportation within their capacities to and from their medical appointments. And we have had a long period of time and conversation about non-emergency medical transportation. I think most of us have been here for all of those conversations through the years. It started out with really being very concerned about the number of times that a person who rides, it calls in for a ride, has to have their authorization reviewed, and the payment methodology that the state had set up to pay the reviewer every time that process occurred. And also the capacity of a reviewer to upgrade or downgrade the level of service and require the passenger to go through significant appeal process in order to restore the level of service that they felt was needed. There were a number of complexities. The difficulties of the payment schedule that was different in terms of the capacity to carry passengers long distances without, when we pay only, you know, for the miles where somebody's sitting inside the vehicle, and the return trips are not reimbursed because we pay only if there's somebody in the vehicle. So that dynamic is very different between a metropolitan area where a transporter can pick up a ride much more quickly and continue to support the system as opposed to a rural legislator. So during the course of this last 7-8 years, we changed the way that we were reimbursing our rides for non-emergency medical transportation, depending on whether or not they were urban, rural, super rural. So there have been changes implemented to the system overall, but eventually the legislature fatigued of this incremental approach and asked a task force to be formed and to really review and take a look at what we could do to improve the entire system on a number of fronts. How we can reduce this constant review that may or may not be, that was found to be unnecessary, how we can adequately pay the providers of the services based on their geography, how we can make sure that the vehicles that are used for transporting medically assisted and vulnerable persons meet standards and qualifications. A variety of questions were reviewed over the course of the last 6 or 7 years. And the task force itself that has met for how long, Ms. Abderholden?
I've lost her.
I think it's years. I think it's 3, maybe 4 years. Under the leadership of Sue Abderholden, who is here with me today, we owe her an enormous expression of gratitude. Last year, as you know, we passed a great deal of policy changes, but because we could not tell for sure, especially under the section of the bill that required all vehicles to have a review and be kept to certain standards, we didn't know how many of those vehicles would need review. We entered a process in which we would try to evaluate that and then based on the outcomes of that evaluation, set a fee structure so that the actual providers of the service would pay for this vehicle review, giving relief, of course, to the costs of the program from the general fund. So what's in front of you today is the legislation that we now need to add, sort of the final piece of the Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Task Force's work that addresses the situation that we're in now. Now that we have data, we can establish a process for vehicle inspection. We can set a fee for that vehicle inspection, and we can establish a payment rate based on the modes and on the geography of this, where the provider is, that restores some of the cuts that were made during the deficit years to the service providers for non-emergency medical transportation. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Abderholden, who will describe what is essentially in this bill and correct anything that I might have said.
Thank you, ma'am.
Welcome, and please
Thank
introduce
you, Madam
yourself.
Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Niagara, Minnesota, Chair of the Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Task Force. And thank you, Senator Sharon, for taking this on all of these years. So first of all, remember last year we tried to create kind of one administrative structure. So we were going to get rid of STS and ATS and put them together and just have modes of transportation. We weren't able to implement that because we didn't have the money. And as Senator Sharon said, we also didn't know if we were going to have all the ATS vehicles now get certified and their drivers trained, how many that would be. So we created basically kind of like a waiver or variance process. Through that, we discovered that it's a little over 700 vehicles. If we were only going to charge those vehicles for adding staff onto DOT to certify them, it was going to be pretty substantial. So the group decided that everybody should just pay a little bit. So STS and ATS vehicles will all pay about $45. We got the fiscal note earlier today. There will actually be a little bit of money that will come, not the first year, but the second and then on, a little couple of thousand dollars that will come back to the state from that. So that should cover those costs. The second thing is we know that we want people to use the cheapest form of transportation possible, which frankly is individual mileage. So we want to pay people for the gas to basically drive themselves or drive a family member. That's the cheapest way that you can go. And we just haven't paid very much. And so one of the things we do is up that to the IRS mileage rate. So there's really an incentive to do that. And I think the other thing to realize is that a lot of these people are living on very, very low incomes. So while being reimbursed 20 cents a mile, you know, could really be a hardship if they actually got to 50 cents, that makes it more doable. And again, we get rid of all those, you know, kind of infrastructure issues that we have to deal with. The other thing, especially for rural Minnesota, is to increase the rate for volunteer mileage. Now, we've made this optional because the way the IRS looks at it, if you get reimbursed as a volunteer above what they set, that money could be considered income. And so for some elderly people, if they were driving a lot and they had a certain amount, it would actually be a disadvantage. So we don't want to force them to take the increased rate, but if they want to, they could, and that could really help in rural Minnesota. Then we get rid of the 4.5% cut that was given to everyone. You know, a lot of people took cuts several years ago during the recession. These providers did as well. That was particularly hard for them when gas prices were up. Luckily, the gas prices are down, but we still want to go back and increase that rate. And this is all according to kind of the ranking that the committee did. And then last but not least was actually to finally fund the new modes of transportation so that we move away from ATS and STS and kind of get down in there. And then my favorite issue, protected transport, would be funded in there as well. So I'll just make a push to kind of get through all those so we can get to protected transport. We have, again, worked very hard to try to get everyone happy. We're 99% there, which I think is close
Amazing.
Enough for me. And we've tried to really address everyone's concerns as a part of this, reassure the counties that they don't take over this whole issue until we actually fund them to do that unified system, which that's the one piece that we're not there yet because we have to figure out the kind of technology piece. But we are so close to being done with this group, which would be great.
And I would just add that
so that you understand modes, what we mean by modes, we have, in order to address, we had a list of difficulties we were trying to resolve with this proposal, and one of them was this kind of constant struggle about do you go to ATS or STS, and that means a lesser structured travel system with less safety measures and less requirements on the drivers, and then STS, which was more of a wheelchair, more complex carrier system. We've removed that. That's the single system. There's only one system now, and what it is that we assess the person's needs based on definitions of and whatever the definition, whatever the assessment tells us is the set of realities for the person's ability to be mobile aligns with the definition, and that's a defined mode of transportation. So that's what we're talking about for modes. And once a mode is established, the frequency with which we are going to change which mode they have is substantially reduced, which has enormous cost savings capacity to it. So that's really what's in the bill. We are really thrilled to be here with you tonight, even though it's late, because, you know, it's just Ms. Abderholden and I tonight, but I can tell you there's an army of people that have given hours and hours and hours of time over the last several years from the counties, from the various departments of the state, providers, it took us so long to get the group to believe that one another really wanted a good outcome and that we could problem solve that together instead of fighting with each other about our interest areas. But we got there, we created a plan, and it's in front of you, and I hope that you'll support it.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Sharon. Questions, members? I saw Senator Rosen, and then Senator Hayden, Senator Eaton, Senator Nelson.
Oh, boy. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Sharon. The first time I met you, you have taken this subject on, and I applaud you for your diligence and getting this figured out. And I was going to say congratulations on disbanding this task force, but then Ms. Abderholden said 99.9%. Sure, so perhaps we have to come back next year, but you've done the yeoman's work, and I really congratulate you on your hard work, both of you, and to the task force.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I also applaud you. I've been listening to this since I started in the legislature when I was in the House, so seems like a decade ago, not quite yet. But and I just wanted to make sure that I wanted to move the bill, but it looks like we still have maybe a few more questions. So,
Senator Eaton?
I just wanted a quick example of, say I had a client that normally their family drove them, but their car broke down. How would that be addressed in this process? If they needed like a taxi or...
Ms. Abderholden. Madam Chair, Senator Eaton. So what would happen is they would call the number, whether it was in the county or in the metro area, calling MNET to say, I don't have a vehicle available. We actually created in the policy manual kind of a series of questions, and they could say, my car is no longer available, I need a ride, and they would do a quick assessment about, you know, whether could they take a bus or not, or could they take a cab, kind of depending on what their needs are. And one thing I want to point out is we're very careful about just saying anyone who's ambulatory has to take a bus, because we wanted to actually take into account that for some people, if there were no transfers required, they could do it. But then with some people, if there were multiple transfers, they might not be able to do that. In the winter, you might not want to have an elderly person who normally could take the bus with ice on the sidewalks not want to do that, or someone with schizophrenia in August with the heat and not being able to sweat, having to stand outside for a long time. So I think our the policy manual that we developed really does look at all of that.
Okay. Thank you. I do want to thank you also. I've not been working on your committee, but I've been out in the field trying to deal with this. That's why I wanted a practical, if I ran into this, how it would work, and I thank you very much.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, too, add my thanks. This is an important issue for my district and for us all. And I have a question, which I want to make sure that is, you know, just when you get all the answers, they change the questions, right? And so my question has to do with something called a universal cab, and you might be familiar with that. But one of the issues that we found, not tied just to medical rides, but to people in wheelchairs who need rides,
those cabs are only available during business hours. And so, in other words, they're not able to take the cab to see the play down at the Civic Theater, or they're not able to take, or they're not able to get their loved one home on Christmas, because while the cabs might be operating, the actual vehicles that have the wheelchair accessibility are not. They have limited access hours and exorbitant fees. And so in looking at that, we're looking at these universal cabs, which actually can haul, can have, you know, three people and a wheelchair, or four people without a wheelchair. And my question is, in your, as you've designed these modes, is it going to be able to take into account newer modes of transportation that actually are kind of like a universal vehicle that haul not that haul that take people whether they're in wheelchairs or not?
I would defer to Ms. Adderhill in accepting to say that we have other transportation mobility needs for persons with who are in wheelchairs. Timeframes of services when they're available. I want to remind you that in this instance, what we're talking about is only those who are going from their home to a medical appointment and back. That's all that's authorized under this proposal. That's all we're dealing with here. And then in terms of whether or not those new models of vehicles and systems might work for this, there's criteria in here about whether or not a vehicle meets the requirements and the standards for the various modes. They have to meet criteria and get approval through the Department of Transportation, get a sticker, or I can't remember what we call it, some kind of a decal that's placed on their window. There is limitations as to the description that they can use of what their service is based on what's required in this bill. So the potential is there, but it's like anything. You have to meet the criteria. It has to meet the expectations that are in the bill for service provision.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Senator, if I can just add, that would really be up to the Department of Transportation, whether that vehicle met their standards. So we kind of have to leave it up to them in terms of, you know, how they certify vehicles.
Yeah, that's what the decal is what's received once they've received that certification. And they can't provide the service under this bill and be reimbursed for it by medical assistance without that.
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair. So my comment was just in hopes then that this, as this legislation is rolled out, that it certainly does allow for some of our newer modes of transportation for people who need wheelchairs, which would be something along a universal cab line.
Sure. Members, any other questions, comments?
If there are no other questions, I'd be happy to move.
Senator Sarin.
I'd be happy to, before there are any more questions, I'd be happy to move Senate File 1292 be passed and referred to
transportation.
As amended and referred to transportation.
On Senator Sharon's motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, Senator Sharon. And our meeting is now adjourned.
Seeing no further business.